Today's sponsor is Shudder, the premium streaming video service devoted to horror, thrillers, and suspense. Backed by AMC Networks, Shudder has a growing and dynamic selection of thrilling premieres, originals, and exclusives, including Rob Zombie's 31, The Ring vs. The Grudge franchise, Mashup, Sadako vs. Kayako, and We Are the Flesh, which I still haven't seen, and now I have a reason to watch it, which I'm very excited about. Shudder is also the only place to find legendary BBC film Ghostwatch, now available in the US for the first time ever, which I also need to see, and people have been telling me for years. Somebody even gave me a DVD of it, and I didn't watch it, so all the more bonus for me. Shudder is available on the web, iOS, Android, Chromecast, Apple TV, and Roku for $4.99 a month, or $49.99 with an annual membership. But Shockwave listeners can get a free month by entering promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of horror available to stream anywhere. And I also just saw one of the programmers of there while I was in New York, Sam Zimmerman, awesome guy. They make great content.
Guys, welcome to Shockwaves.
This is episode 49. Okay.
Where's Ryan?
We're a man down yet again.
Yeah, Ryan.
We traded Ryan for you, I guess.
Yeah, Ryan, we're ships passing in the night now, guys. Ryan, it's this way for a chunk of convention season, actually. Ryan is now at the Overlook Film Festival in the Pacific Northwest.
All right, let's be honest. Ryan has gone to the Middle East to find a sculptor, somebody willing to sculpt a fake Rondo because he feels so left out.
I feel pretty bummed about
that.
We're
runner-up.
Okay.
Take it.
Two good things. For one, thank you all for your voting or not voting, whatever you did.
Because I'm ecstatic that we're runner-up, which means that people did vote for us, and that is freaking awesome.
We are runner-up to one of our cinematic heroes in our lives, Joe Dante. But we're also runner-up to something that isn't even a podcast. And we were the runner-up, which means we are still the horror podcast. So I think there's a lot of good juju to take from that because they are not. It's a weird category. Multimedia is very strange.
Yeah, because it's multimedia website, which is weird because Shockwaves obviously isn't a website, but neither is Trailers from Hell for that matter.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's a website. You go to it on the web. It's content. It's amazing content too, like one of my favorite sites.
So. I know. I love that one. If I'm going to lose to someone, I think that Trailers from Hell, Joe Dante is who I would pick. But
we still need to win one for Ryan one day.
Ryan is never going to get his
Rondo. He deserves it. And he deserves to be a monster kid.
Yeah.
The website was also a runner-up, which warmed my heart. Blumhouse.com. Thank you so much,
I won't
guys.
Ask who won.
By Bloody
I'm
Disgusting.
I'm not going to ask who. Oh, Bloody.
Yeah.
Okay.
Listen, the saving grace of Bloody Disgusting. Well, saving grace is not the appropriate term. John Squires, I've always loved what he's done. Freddy in Space, and he did a lot of stuff for us. I think he's doing a really great job over there.
Oh my God, I've been loving his content. John is just amazing wherever he goes. I'm sad we no longer have him at Blumhouse.com, but I'm thrilled that he's keeping up the good stuff.
Yeah, smartest thing they did was get John on board. So that's that. Here's the deal. This is episode 49. So next week, we're holding off on episode 50 because we want Texas Frightmare to be episode 50.
It's going to be awesome.
So we will be there in Dallas, Texas from May 5th to the 7th. But there won't be too much of a break. We're going to try to squeeze in a few bonus episodes while we're gone. So that way it should be this episode 49, a couple of bonus things, and then we will air 50 about a week after Texas Frightmare is wrapped. Mm-hmm. We're going to do it live in front of an audience, but we will tape stuff. We'll try to get some little mini interviews if we can. We're going to see, it's pretty crazy once we get there and settle. We're not really sure. It's very unpredictable what we'll be able to do.
We do this every year where we're like, we should plan out the interviews in advance. And then we start reaching out to the celebrities and all they ever say is, just come by my booth. And then we will show up at the booth. There will be a line going out the door. And then we're like, hi, can we get that interview now?
Yeah, it's the kind of place
you improvise.
Yeah.
Well, it's the kind of place you aim for Argento and you settle for drinking. And that's just Texas.
And that's fair enough.
So when you get a bonus episode that's all of us in a hotel room drinking and playing Cards of Humanity at 3 a.m., that's what you get.
You've been warned. That might be episode 50.
It distinctly could be episode 50.
Yeah.
But it'll be awesome.
In a sense, we're lucky. You guys are lucky we didn't win the award because last time we won the award, what happened, Rob?
We
that was the end of our show, the next episode.
Yeah, we quit the next episode.
And you all had to suffer for 24 hours of thinking we were gone.
A whole 24, yeah.
So, you know, so this way we're going to have to keep going for another year at least.
We gotta keep going.
Got no choice now.
Yeah.
All righty.
But well, we, while we're talking about the convention really quick, since this is technically our last true episode before the convention, I do want to say we are doing a ton of panels while we're at Texas Frightmare. We have a booth for Blumhouse.com and Shockwaves. We will also be selling some of our own stuff there as well. I'll be selling the Hellraiser comic. Rob's going to have a Psycho Doc.
I'll be selling yellow handkerchiefs for your front pocket. You have to see.
Is that a cruising reference?
Yes. Oh yes. I love you for getting that reference. Hey, wow. Al Pacino's birthday yesterday. You know,
I lived above the bar where they shot that.
I think I've heard that story after 4 years with you online.
I think I know all your stories, Elric.
Pretty much. That's
yeah. But yeah, so we're going to be there. We have a ton of panels. Please come check us. I even just got another panel today. I'm now doing the Puppet Master remake panel, guys.
Holy crap.
Whoa.
Yeah. Excuse me. So it's going to be crazy fun. And we have Blumhouse.com stickers that we're going to have at the booth as well. So come see us for Texas Frightmare. Fucking be there.
Yeah. And don't hesitate. Look, I was just I was in New York this week and I was just telling these guys, but this was pretty phenomenal. So if you're somebody I met on this trip, it kind of blew my mind. So I'm on the East Coast. I fit in a lot of movies while I was there. I was there partially for Tribeca, but I was also just going to movie theaters at Draft House in Brooklyn, Draft House in Yonkers, a couple other places. I went to 5 different movie venues across the city, and in 4 of those, somebody ran up to me saying they were a Shockwaves fan. One of them, somebody bought me a beer who didn't, you know, recognize me from the back at front of there at the front. I didn't even see my face. Somehow they just knew it was me, sent it back. So to get that
it's
kind
the
of
aroma.
It's the aroma
you
of
smell
Cain,
like
the
Elric.
Cain aroma. But to get that kind of to have people who are the kind of, I hate to say this, the kind of listeners you want, but people who are really loving movies. One guy was one of the people running the Draft House in Brooklyn. Sorry, I've lost some name. One guy was Matt Barone, who runs the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival.
Wow.
He was doing the Q&As at the Tribeca, both screenings I went to, and straight away me and him started talking because he just is one of those guys who's always active on our on Twitter and everything. So it was super cool.
And you get to hang out with Ging.
Yes,
the
and
gang,
I yes,
Michael
and I'd never met Gingold, and he was at the Abbey screening in the middle of nowhere. Like we're an hour out of New York City, so I didn't expect that to happen.
I can't believe you went to New York City to see Abbey.
Well, that wasn't why, but it, actually,
that was the
yeah.
main reason. That
I
was
think that's a good reason to go.
Factor.
It's really worth a cross country trip.
Well, that's so. Anyway, I just want to thank all those people who came up to me because, and what I want to say is, like, at Texas, come up to us, man, because it is such
a thrill
for us. Yeah. Don't like hide back and oh, they don't want to meet me because you know they're just whatever. No, for us, this is like crazy. We're web celebrities, come on, that's nothing. Like, that's like probably below politicians. So, you know, please come up to us, make us feel good.
It's, wow.
But I might as well jump into Abbey just because me and Rob saw this.
Yeah, tell us about New York. And it's probably the same print because I think there's
only one. Here's the interesting thing. It was advertised as a major kind of a restoration 2K scan by AGFA, so the American Genre Film Archive. My co-writer, my friend who was out there staying with, he had never seen it, so he was excited. And we go to it. I swear to God, I kind of looked exactly as like that 16mm print, maybe a touch below. And I was like, whoa, if this is the 2K scan and a restoration, think how bad all the copies of this film must be. And it's still awesome. So, like, AGFA does the awesomest work. But, like, I was watching it going, whoa. Usually when you see, like, I'm going to go see a DCP, it usually looks pristine. This literally looks like watching the 16mm print.
Wow.
Now, is there a DVD of Abbey? Because I have a bootleg.
There's a bad, like, not a correct one, and it's bad.
Maybe it isn't a bootleg. Maybe I have the original. What I have was so dark and grainy that it's painful to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it's dark and grainy. I mean, yeah. I don't, you know what's weird? When we saw it on 16mm, my feeling, I never once felt, oh man, this film looks all messed up.
No, that was a really good 16mm print. And I was of the understanding that that's like the one, I think somebody on our group had claimed that it was theirs.
Right.
So that's the one they should be scanning, is the one we got to see at the
same
time.
So, you know, the quick cut of what that is if you haven't seen it, and I've talked about it obviously on this show a long time ago and on Pure Cinema recently for the ripoffs, but, you know, Abbey is really one, it's a really entertaining William Girdler film, part of the ripoff cycle, but this is one that made a lot of money very quickly. I think it made $4 million in a couple weeks on its release because of the drive-ins and the popularity of Exorcist until the people put out Exorcist realized they got it pulled. It's one of the few lawsuits that actually stuck. A lot of these a lot of these kind of grindhouse movies actually snuck under the radar and kind of would get away with it. This one didn't. Girdler never saw any of those profits. You know, I think while still a lawsuit going for the profits, by the time he had actually passed away. So anyway, but it's an amazing film and it really holds up. You know what, though? The crowd we saw it with was one of the most entertaining screenings of my life. This crowd hardly made any sound. Mm. It was very quiet. So I was watching it almost like as a good movie instead of a crazy movie. And it still kind of held up like, oh, this is pretty interesting. Like the fact that this guy is making this movie with this all black cast that's very regional and the dialogue and like he kind of subverts certain stereotypes and dives into others and makes it just like work. It's a truly fascinating film. And I would assume that AGFA will be putting out, I would assume, a DVD of this scan, if this is as good as it's ever going to get, if the legality side of it's washed up. But man, it's a fun movie. And it's just, you know, it's just seeing it with a crowd, you're always just, you're curious which lines. But as soon as it goes full motherfuckers, it becomes such an amazing movie when it like kind of makes that turn. So that was cool. I was off the plane. There's a few I just resaw, so I want to just like scan over those. I wouldn't go, and then we can kind of round table it. When I first got off the train, I got off the plane. I'd been in New York for an hour and a half, and somebody texted me, "Hey, did you know Blue Velvet's playing in 35 millimeter, like 30 blocks from you? And Greta Gerwig has never seen the movie. And the whole point of the screening cycle is celebrities come to see a movie that they somehow missed in their life. So it's Greta Gerwig and her husband Noah Baumbach made Squid and the Whale and a whole
what
bunch of other
movies. What theater was this at?
It was a new film called. It was one that's been there forever called The Quad, but it only got reopened, so it's okay. Got a big refurbish. I don't want to throw anyone on the bus, but the entire film was basically soft focus, and I was the only one afterwards who was kind of like, "What the fuck?" Like, I was so into the movie, I didn't want to complain, but afterwards I'm like, "How did that happen? Like, you guys have this big reopening, and I'm watching a soft focus version, and they were just like, oh, the lenses and everything." DCP now, so it was 35 mil and we didn't stuff was off, and I'm like, yeah, you know, you should probably fucking give me my money back, and no one even offered, and I was like, come on guys, like, so because I loved the movie so much, I was just like, you know what, it's all good, man. I'm just going to walk the streets of New York, and I let it go. Besides, you know, throwing you under the bus on this podcast. so, you know,
should have given him his money back.
But it was kind of cool to watch somebody who, you know, Greta Gerwig's becoming, you know, a pretty major actress now. Wait, for horror fans, she's famous for having her face blown the fuck off by a certain A.J. Bowen in a certain House of the Devil.
Oh, yeah.
Let me just put it this way. She is not the babysitter, for all those who don't know who Greta Gerwig is. Anyway, that was super entertaining, and I still think Frank Booth has the best character introduction of anyone in any movie ever. It's just, like, the best. Couple other ones I rewatched High Tension, and I've never talked about that on the show because the first time I saw High Tension was in theaters, and it has the weirdest thing. I don't know if you've – I'd like to know what copy you have, but this film starts off with the French actresses speaking English, and then as soon as the villain comes in, he is subtitled for half the movie, and the family's subtitled, and you're like, it's the most schizophrenic, like, audio job I've ever seen because it's bad English, so it's not like they were naturally English speakers. And it makes no sense, the kind of the whole dubbing situation. I don't think I've ever seen a film that's half English, half subtitles, but for no good reason.
I've only seen it in French with subtitles, and I know it was dubbed for America,
and
but not
the whole thing's dubbed. That's the weird thing.
That's weird. Sure,
and this was like this was on Shudder, I think.
Yeah, I've only seen it with full subtitles when it first came out.
But the film, on a visceral aesthetic level, still really just completely holds up. The first 30 minutes are just unbelievable filmmaking, the tension you feel, you know, then, and I'm not going to ruin it because if anyone wants to see this movie, hasn't seen it, there's a huge twist, very, you know, fairly radical and polarizing twist. And what I was interested about seeing, I saw it with somebody who hadn't seen it before. So his viewing is totally different. He's just taking it in. My viewing the second time was like, okay, 10 years, you know, I've seen this 10 years apart now. I'm watching this film purely thinking about the twist and how it plays out on these story things, and it's complete horseshit. I mean, really, there's a couple moments where I'm like, oh yeah, no, I can justify the, you know, this. And then at a certain point, like, no, it's just been done to be a twist. And I know that came from the fifth element. What's the direct? Luc Besson. Mm-hmm. That was Luc Besson's story note that he forced on them early on. So they had a slasher script, and, you know, and Aja went with it and made it work. It wasn't like a note after they'd filmed, but it just, yeah, I'd be very curious. This could be a good shocker if you're aware of our shocker fan club, or what are they called, the movie club?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This would be a good discussion in there for how people feel about it, because it's one of those movies that I've never met somebody who's kind of like on the fence about it. You kind of fall one way or other. But you can't deny Aja's filmmaking. It's such a great debut on an international film. But yeah, ton more stuff, but we can, you know, swing around.
I saw the Transfiguration.
Oh, yeah, I was interested.
Yeah, I moderated the Q&A at the New Art screening this weekend. And the director was there and one of the producers and one of the actors, too. The crowd loved it, like absolutely thought it was fantastic. I will say, if you're a horror fan and you've seen every horror film ever made, you're going to watch it and go, oh, it's Martin. And yeah, it is. It's about a boy who truly believes he is a vampire and he is killing people, but he's not like supernatural, no teeth, no, you know, he can't fly or anything. He's just a normal dude who believes he's a vampire. And so, but he feels bad about what he's doing. And then he falls in love and meets a, well, I can't say he falls in love. He meets a girl and he definitely gets interested in her. And that just kind of makes him realize how bad the things he's doing are, and he wants to be normal, but he can't. There is a lot of heavy, heavy social stuff thrown into this movie. So much so that that was like the one critique I heard was like, man, it felt like he just threw in everything. There's suicide. For some reason, the girl like has sex with five guys at the very start of the movie. His brother has PTSD. There's obviously some poverty issues. They're living in New York City. There's child abuse. So it really feels like a lot has been thrown into this movie, and it's heavy. But that said, like it got some moments to it. Like there was some really good stuff to it. Some people were saying, oh my God, this is going to redefine the vampire genre. I don't know if it's going to do that. Because it's something that we have seen.
I was wondering
before.
If those people have ever seen vampires.
I know.
It's like, Twilight redefined.
This is a redefining movie, and it's like, but have you seen Martin?
Martin.
Or Habit. No. Or The Addiction.
Or Let the Right One In.
It feels like Habit, especially because it is, whereas Martin was set in, you know, inner city Philadelphia, this is set in inner city. It's New York City. Like a lot of it's New York City, but they film most of it in Rockaway. And so, I mean, it's very inner city. Like you're staring at buildings and people walking past and kids on the street running around, and it takes place in like project housing. So yeah, it's very much, it feels in the vein of Habit, Martin, these kind of vampires in inner city, and it's that whole psychological, well, is he a vampire? Well, does it matter? He's killing people. So in that regard, it's because you're following him, it definitely has kind of a Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer vibe as well.
Okay.
So, yeah, it looks up our alley.
Yeah, I want to see it.
You guys, I will say, Dave came with me, and he was like in love with it, but he'd never seen Martin before. But I was like, there were parts of it that I was like, oh my God. And I do have to say, the cinematography is gorgeous. The person who shot it, because it's all concrete buildings, but they feel alive, and there's like this crazy depth of field with the city. So even though it's generally like an ugly kind of flat environment, it's beautiful on screen.
Is this a mid-range indie, or is this like it's above like a Battery kind of budget?
Oh, way above. This is like $2 to $3 million, I'm guessing.
Oh, okay. So a bigger movie.
Yeah, wow. It was definitely.
Looked much smaller than that.
I only saw photos, so I thought.
And they announced in the Q&A that a lot of like the New York City shots were stolen, and they ended up stealing a bunch of shots, like a lot of the outside stuff. But I think it was
indie
around.
Or studio?
Indie.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm going to guess $2 to $3 million. I'm going to look it up right now, though. I'm intrigued.
All right,
myself.
I'm going to predict it's $350,000 because that's what you can make look too.
For me, I had a stack of stuff that I bought at Monsterpalooza from both Vinegar Syndrome and Severn Films. So I've been slowly making my way through it. I grabbed another one from Vinegar Syndrome called Psychic Killer, and this is from 1975. It was directed by Ray Danton, who was primarily known as an actor. I'm not very familiar, but I watched some of the special features and then looked it up after. And this was his segue into directing. And this movie is as crazy and wonderful as Vinegar Syndrome titles tend to promise. Basically, it's a guy who gets falsely accused of murder in the opening. And not only accused of murder, but then put in a mental institution. And then he meets another inmate at the mental institution who is basically like, you know, he has like this pendant around his neck, and he's like, tonight I'm going to take out the guy that put me here. He's like, and then I'm just going to kill myself. And he's like, okay. And he's like, but if you want, I'll pass it on to you. So basically that's kind of what happens. And then he passes off this pendant to the guy. And of course, the moment that happens, he gets cleared of all charges. Like, oh yeah, you didn't murder anybody and you're not crazy. So you can leave the institute now. So he gets out. And apparently what this like kind of this pendant does is when you fall asleep, you can astral project yourself out of your body. And so one by one, he goes after, you know, the people that were on the jury and like the judge and like anyone involved with him getting accused of murder, he kind of goes after. And there's some pretty ridiculous, like, there's another shower murder in there that I thought was pretty fantastic. It's like every Vinegar Syndrome movie has a shower murder that I've been watching. So there's that. Crazy. And, it remind me of Patrick a little bit, except, you know, Patrick is always comatose through the whole thing, whereas this guy has to physically go to sleep to do it. And what's great is there's kind of a little, it's worth it for kind of the fucked up ending because basically there's a detective that kind of figures out that this guy has to be behind. He's like, well, this is the motive is, you know, this guy got put to jail and these are the people that are dying. And basically the main guy that does the astral projection is just gloating about it. It's almost like, well, you can't prove it. Like, so they're both like total dicks to each other. And I don't want to give it away, but basically what the detective does is one of like the opposite of heroic. It's like the worst. It's pretty fucked up. I'll just put it to you that way. But I was fascinated by it and had a really good time.
It has a good cover, I remember.
Great cover. Yeah. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think you're going to really get a kick out of how batshit it gets.
And we'll post the photo, but if you actually remember Trump's inauguration, you can see him wearing the pendant, which is awesome. That's how you become president, that pendant. One thing I like doing when I was in New York is I like to try to see a couple New York films. I like to try to see one maybe I haven't seen. I'd been meaning to see Inferno again. And I just done that Suspiria episode on that one show. So I was like, okay, cool. We're about to meet Dario, you know. And Inferno, I always thought was gorgeous, but I hadn't watched it. I had never seen the Blu-ray of it. I saw a 35mm print. And, you know, it's New York, on quote marks. There's probably three shots taken in New York,
right.
But it's set in New York. You know what? The thing is, this film really is completely a worthy sequel to Suspiria, but there's one clear difference. And I never could put my finger on it till watching it this time. And the difference is no Jessica Harper and double down from that. No protagonist. And so it's got all the most beautiful set pieces, and every episodic sequence is as good almost as Suspiria. It's just short because of the goblin as well.
I can enlighten you on a lot of this.
Because
I worked on the Blu-ray.
Oh, cool. but the idea of not having, you know, you're experiencing a Suspiria, so you're experiencing the surreal fairy tale nightmare through Jessica Harper. And when you remove her in this film, you're with the sister for the opening, and then it moves to a friend character of the guy. Then suddenly Lee McCluskey's the guy, and you're following him for a while, but then he's off screen for the next 40 minutes, and then he only comes back at the end. So it's got this fractured, almost like a Robert Altman version of an Argento film.
Okay.
And I know Argento was sick through parts of it. I don't know if that has much.
No, okay. I'll give you the abbreviated version of this as much as possible, because for the Blue Underground Blu-ray, I was fortunate enough to, and this will come into play a little bit later in our episode, just because we're going to be talking about special features with our guests. But basically, I got to do the interview with both Lee McCluskey and Irene Miracle, who are the brother sister of this film. Both in the same day. And it was one of those weird magical experiences where you're just like, you didn't expect your day to turn out that way. And both of them were really frank and candid. And they both had the complete opposite reaction to Argento, which is Lee got along with him really well. Irene did not.
Yeah.
And basically the main thing was, and she talks about this on camera. And what was great about this was this, that she's being very careful what she said. We started the interview. It was me and Buzz Wallach. And she's being very careful about what she was saying, doing the usual spiel. And for whatever reason, we had a problem with our camera. And Buzz is like, I'm so sorry. Do you mind if I just, you know, charge and switch out this tape, whatever, 15 minutes? And in that 15 minutes, she's like, well, do you guys want a cup of tea? Or, you know, so we sat and she's like, I'll be honest with you. I really did not have a good time in this movie. And I really didn't get along with Dario at all. And she started telling us stories. And I was like, you have to tell this on camera. Like, you have to.
Yeah.
She's like, that's what people want to hear, is I want you to, you have to be honest about it. So if we had not had that glitch, I don't know if we would have gotten the great interview we got. And basically what happened was Argento cast her, everything was fine. And then right before they started shooting, she started losing all her hair. And she didn't know what it was. She thought she had some weird fucked up disease. And basically Argento was in the process of getting a divorce, had just found out that he had contracted a disease basically not in a good mood to begin with, and was convinced that he's like, this actress I hired, now she's going to die while I'm making this movie.
Oh, my God.
So last minute, he rewrote and tried to get her out of the movie as quickly as possible, and was kind of a shit to her because he didn't think she was going to survive the shoot anyway. And it turned out it was a very common, you know, she eventually, they were able to pinpoint what it was. And, you know, she got over it, you know, all her hair fell out and then it grew back in once she got over this, this sickness. But so she had a terrible time. And the underwater sequence, you know, she said Lombardo Bava directed it all.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, Dario wouldn't even talk to me. He was throwing chairs through windows, fighting his wife. So I barely worked with him. It was Bava that worked with me.
That's like the total magic of movies, how a movie can come together and seem like it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Given
yeah.
that behind the scenes, magic. People are, because I know, yeah, I know Bill Lustig was like a PA or an assistant director on that one for the New York stuff
yeah.
because
yeah.
he was about to do Maniac and Lombardo Bava. And then Mario Bava comes in
yes.
to help with these crazy effects sequences
yeah, yeah.
at the end, which are literally as close to like cinema magic. Like
right.
there's some of my favorite moments, but I really think that despite all that, and especially the underwater scenes are a gorgeous way to start. It really is almost the equal, but it's just because you don't have someone to experience the movie. There's no emotional connection.
Right.
So it's, but it has the beauty and it definitely makes you wonder, and I'm going to revisit Mother of Tears next because it makes me wonder like, okay, it's one thing. Mother of Tears to me had like one really good scene, but it makes you wonder why didn't you try to at least replicate the style of the other?
Yeah, two? The colors.
I don't know why you
like
even
that, yeah.
made this movie if you weren't doing that.
Yeah.
And so that's something I'd love to ask Argento, not on record. Just to ask. I heard from his perspective, Inferno was the hardest movie ever made. In that little interview, I think it's on there.
Yeah.
And he doesn't specify why. So it could be the personal, but it could also be at a certain point putting the style. I know that the sets get really hot from reading about Suspiria. Like, it's very dangerous for the actors because there's so much light being pumped into these sets. So
yeah.
who knows? Maybe it's just too physically demanding.
Yeah, but yeah.
I'd love to know.
Yeah, you should watch those interviews if you
haven't already. I watched the one with the woman. I didn't watch the Lee McCluskey.
Oh, Lee's amazing because he's like this crazy artist too.
He's from Dallas, right? Like he's from the TV show Dallas.
Yeah, yeah. And he was in Just One of the Guys and a bunch of stuff. Yeah. But with him, neither of them could speak to each other because he didn't speak Italian. Is it? Yeah. So his brother translated, but he tells a great story about like, they're like, okay, Lee, we need you, you know, at the end when the whole thing's in fire, yeah. like, we need you to run through flames. And he's like, you know, I'm a young guy. And I'm like, how dangerous could it be? And he's like, I wasn't acting. He's like, I could feel
That's
flames behind me. And it's just like, I'm trying not to die. Well, it is, but it's great. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, if you watch The Spirit recently, if you're not waiting for, of course, the beautiful synapse one we'll get one day, you jump into Inferno. It's really gorgeous. And the cool thing about it, and this is actually maybe the main argument, maybe you didn't need a Mother of Tears because actually Mother Tenebraeum is a big part of Inferno.
Mm-hmm.
They go to that storyline like two or three times and actually show her quite a lot. And those parts are gorgeous in Italy. So it's almost, in a way, it almost felt like that is almost its self-contained trilogy.
Yeah, they definitely included the three mothers by the end of it.
They're
you
in
knew
it.
Exactly
That's the
who
mythos
it was
is in
be.
This one, yeah.
So to circle back on Transfiguration, I couldn't find the exact budgets, but most of the things that I'm finding, like fans talking about it, are saying under a million. Some are saying like 750 to 500,000. So, which actually sounds right now, knowing that all of the shots that I'm thinking, like, oh my God, that must have, you know, cost a million, are all these outside shots of New York City, which we now know were stolen.
So it'll be 350 grand.
So yeah,
I'm sticking with that number.
That actually does not sound that far off, knowing that, you know, it's
Could
three
be.
Actors and most
you can
of
never
shot
tell
in
with
an apartment.
Them, I mean, I would have thought Eyes of My Mother looks like almost expensive in a way, but you know it's not. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then
just looks good.
Other movies, like I thought that It Follows had to be kind of on the cheap side, and that one was
expensive.
Like 7 million.
Yeah. No, I think it was like two or something, two and a half. Well,
two
I don't know.
Half?
It was definitely, yeah.
It was a couple million. Yeah.
So. The other New York one I hadn't seen, I really think you got to get, if you haven't seen them, I thought I'd seen all of Ferrera's like key period movies, but I realized I'd never seen Fear City, and this is the sleaziest of all his New York films.
Oh my gosh,
okay,
yeah. I watched this one in New York as well.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, if you like, and I know you do, Rob, and I know most of our listeners love, and if you haven't seen it, jump out. 10 to Midnight, classic, brilliant. This is very much like a sister film to 10 to Midnight. Basically, I would pitch it to you like this. Young, hot Tom Berenger versus a martial arts slasher on the streets of New York City.
Sold.
And the backdrop, peak Melanie Griffith, nude, dancing on a pole for the whole movie. Because she's a stripper at the strip club that these guys basically provide girls to, Tom Berenger. Then all the girls in this town are being slashed up by some weird puritanical martial arts guy who believes only perfect things can go in his body. It makes no sense. There's no backstory to him. And it ends with literally Tom Berenger, who's an ex-prize-fighting boxer, on the streets going toe-to-toe with the slasher killer. And in between, it's just the sleaziest New York movie. And If that wasn't enough, Lando Calrissian as the cop, main cop of the movie, yelling, barking orders at them like just a crazy man.
Now, this one has a nice Blu-ray via Shout Factory
that's what
own,
I was watching.
Which is nice. But I actually, I saw like an Abel Ferreira screening in New York City when I was living there. And this was one of the ones that they screened. But yeah, it's a fun film.
It's a crazy movie. So it's hard for me to even believe, because I think King of New York is a fucking masterpiece, like Criterion Collection masterpiece type thing. And it's hard to believe that this director is the same human making these movies, because this is just so ridiculous in a way. But it's also like, so like, if you're like, when I go to New York, I always just kind of, I'm a little sad that the New York when I was like, you know, 13 just doesn't exist. You know,
you mean it's nice and clean now?
It's just so boring. It's just like, there's no weird place to put a quarter in
until
and watch a naked girl
there.
With a weird,
because this is when people ask me the difference between, oh, and they are, honey, they're just
somewhere
on 9th
else.
Avenue.
No, but I can't
like
go that far.
9th and 48. That's where you get the peep shows still. But when people ask me the difference between living in Los Angeles and living in New York, I say in New York, I would not have even hesitated to go out at 2 a.m. and walk to the drugstore to buy Tylenol.
Everyone's awake.
Everyone's awake. It's totally safe now. I felt so safe living in my neighborhood in New York. I never even thought twice. You could not fucking pay me to go walk around my neighborhood in LA at 2 a.m. And
Well, you couldn't pay you to walk.
Exactly.
In LA, no
one's
walking.
Who the hell walks here? And I mean, I live blocks from a CVS. I would never walk there.
But if you're looking for that seedy side, this is a perfect one to drop into, because it's just, I feel like it paints the picture a bit better than like Miss 45 and Bad Lieutenant in terms of like the streets of New York. It's just a lot of fun to look at.
Well, speaking of New York, I'll go to this one. So I rewatched Brain Damage because I'm trying to prepare, because we're doing all those panels and we get to Texas Frightmare. So I have to watch 31 at some point.
Did they give you the Blu-ray already, or is it
something
else? No,
I'm watching like my shitty old DVD. It's actually not that bad of a DVD version, but I'm assuming that the Blu-ray is going to be nice and fancy.
Elmer
with an A, who's actually voiced by Zach Hurley.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah.
So yeah, it's just, I just have always loved this film. I'm so excited to do the Hennenlotter panel, just because his films, and they're all so mature and sexualized, but for some reason I loved them when I was a kid. Like, these were ones that I was watching around the same time as like Return of the Living Dead and Ghoulies and things like that. And so Brain Damage, Basket Case, Frankenhooker. I mean, that was like my trilogy right there. And so revisiting Brain Damage, it's just like, it's just like comfort food for me. It's so neon. It's so 1980s. And it kind of makes me sad that Hennenlotter has not gone on to do a bunch of other stuff. Mm. Like, I wish he had kept going. And
I never saw Bad Biology. That was later.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. It's very different, though, because he wrote it. He co-wrote it with R.A. Rugged Man, the rapper, who did the tour with him on the like Basket Case bonus features.
Weird.
And it's cool, but it almost has it has both their voices very much. Like even the dialogue and the narration is very, you know, it kind of rhymes. It's very rap oriented.
Okay, mm-hmm.
So it's weird.
It looked almost Troma-ish to me when I saw the trailer, and that warned me off at the time.
It has a Troma feel, and it's weird because, and Rob and I were talking about this in the office today about how some of the films from the 80s, just because they were shot on film, and even though that they were low budget as shit, they still have like a really good production value to them. And though when you're looking at something like Brain Damage or Basket Case, these are gritty, smaller horror films, but they still feel like they've got this crazy production value. So I'm watching Brain Damage and there's like club scenes and crowd scenes and the effects are amazing. And there's all this neon and there's like deliberate lighting and things like that.
Yeah.
And so it still just feels like a huge scope to me.
And it's a pretty trippy head trip of a movie, too.
Oh,
like just some effects.
I think it could be, I mean, personal, like I love Frankenhooker. I think that's probably my favorite. But I think Brain Damage in terms of filmmaking craft is the best thing he's made.
Yeah. Because
there's sequences in there. Like, because obviously the guy has a parasite that kind of injects, you know, hallucinogens into his brain. So I remember there's one beautiful sequence where he's kind of like drugged out on the bed, staring up at the light, and the light turns into an eyeball, and then the whole room fills with like blue water.
Yeah,
and it's like one of the most beautifully
it's gorgeous.
And I think like, how did he do that? Like, it's one of those sequences.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like an indie film. Yeah,
I don't know how the hell he pulled that off at this time period. So, it's beautiful.
I mean, I'm looking forward to Blu-ray of that. That's why I'm holding out.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you have to watch it.
And
you have
it's shot like a noir film where everything's very dark and kind of has a sheen to it, but it's all got this 80s neon that streams through the whole thing. Yeah, it was just, even on my old DVD, it's kind of a visual feast, which is weird because you don't think of, at least prior to rewatching this, I don't think of Hennenlotter as like, oh my God, his visuals. But really, it's there. And the use of the song, I mean, he obviously did have some type of budget because that Glenn Miller song, Elmer's Tune, you know, he sings it throughout and it's just so effective.
I also love Elmer's voice.
Yeah, like, Zachary Lee is just a man. How like, you doing, buddy?
Yeah, you expect it to be like kind of like a weird little demon thing or whatever. Yeah. He's just like, hey.
Which they also do in a Frankenhooker, you know? They kind of go play against type by making her kind of an airhead, you know?
Yeah,
right.
It's such a, yeah, he's such a fun film. And we'll get that. Blu-ray will be out for this weekend.
Yeah, for Texas Frightmare.
That'll be the first thing I'll spend money on. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I highly recommend checking out Brain Damage if you haven't seen it in a while. And if you haven't seen it yet, it's
Wait for the Arrow, yeah.
Yeah, Wait for the Arrow, but it's like a must for all horror fans.
I agree.
All righty. My buddy Josh Miller came over the weekend, and he had obtained a somewhat long-lost VHS classic. He got a DVD of it at Monsterpalooza called Demon Wind. This amazing cover.
I was wanted just for the cover.
The best tagline ever, right?
There's something deadly in the air.
Yes.
It'll blow you away.
Nice.
Okay? This is funny because I was convinced this was an 80s movie, but it's 1990, so I guess technically we could say it's 80s.
Was the cover Lanticular?
Yes.
Okay, Lanticular. That's what I remember.
Now,
it was like a lanticular.
I wish this awesome demon was in the movie. That's on the cover. And actually, it was really funny. Me and Josh got in a debate. Like, you know what? We should remake this and put the cover demon in the movie.
I think there's
we should do a whole series of remakes of movies where we actually deliver on the promise.
I think it's called Demonoid. Was the other one from earlier this year?
Oh yeah, yeah.
And that was like the best poster ever. And that is
it's not
the movie.
Not in the movie.
Well,
not the movie.
Now there's a similar demon, but just not this awesome demon that's in the movie. So. Here's the fun thing about this movie, because it's not good. Let's just get that out of the way.
Yeah.
But we thoroughly enjoyed watching it together. It was written and directed by a guy named Charles Philip Moore. And basically it starts – the reason I like it is because it is a demons movie, and we don't have a lot of those. Like obviously there's the Baba demons movies. But like I like demons like as like a monster that, you know, people transform into them sort of deal. But so the opening I took notes. The opening is pretty kick-ass, where it's a woman fighting her husband who is transforming into a demon and spitting out all sorts of stuff. And basically it's like, oh, you know, I don't know why. If she throws this like snow globe, it will stop them in their tracks or whatever. So she does. And then it ends like this opening scene ends with the most spectacular explosion where the whole budget probably went. And you're like, whoa, that's awesome. Now what? So what happens is, her grandson is now the lead character. He goes visits his dad in the institute, who somehow tells him he has to go back to this cabin where his grandparents died all these years ago. So he gets a bunch of friends, his girlfriend and a couple other people, and they go to this cabin. And the fun – oh, but right before they get to the cabin, he called two more friends to join them. So when they get out of the car, they're magicians. And
okay.
That helps.
Yeah, they just get out and they're magicians.
Great.
And immediately the jock of the bunch starts because I guess the main magician used to date one of the girls, and now he's with the girl's with a jock. So they get an immediate fight where the jock throws a can at the magician, and then he pops the can up like three. He keeps kicking it up, and then he kicks it back into his head. And you're like, oh, wow. And it's like, okay. And they're about to fight or whatever. Like, no, we got to chill out or whatever. I only bring this out because the next scene, they're not in their magician clothes anymore. And there's no reason for them being a magician. The only reason I think it's there is because later when demons attack, he uses the same kick that he did on the can to knock a demon's head off.
Oh, no, it's totally the high school cliques. I mean, you've got the jocks and the magicians.
The magicians
and,
there.
How come they weren't in the Warriors? The magicians.
Well,
the magicians.
Also, there's my favorite thing is there's this one of these girls in there.
When does the wind come in?
Oh, it's coming. It's just so – I couldn't wait to talk about this movie. So then they get to the cabin, and this is actually the coolest idea of it. Is the cabin has been destroyed. So all that's left is standing is a door and like a little bit outside the door. But when they open it, the cabin is fully intact inside.
Oh, cool.
So it's almost like a little portal, like from the outside.
Beyond the gates almost kind of went
Yeah,
for that,
like
on
you
a
see the
budget.
Door, but you're like, what the hell? So they go in, and once they go in, for some strange reason, they're like trapped in this. You know, like they come out when they come out the door, they can't leave this certain vicinity for some stupid reason. I wasn't really paying attention. It didn't really matter at that point.
It was the magicians.
And what's great is one of the girls keeps saying like, oh my God, what if we all die here? Just don't bury me here. And of course, she's the first to die and gets turned into a doll by the demons.
Whoa.
I don't understand. I don't know why.
Why?
She just becomes a doll when they catch it.
Rob, I don't understand.
Listen, all right, we're going to move on. All
right. Doesn't matter. Can't move on, guys.
But here's the thing. So the way that they were acting, the kids and the demons coming out and all that, like I started being like, this is Cabin in the Woods. Like this is totally like exactly like Cabin in the Woods. At least, is this the movie that they, and you know, Josh is like, I don't know, maybe. And then the first time the demons come out, here comes one that looks like a farmer, like a zombie redneck. Oh, I'm like, this is totally Cabin in the Woods. They must have used this obscure movie as kind of like, they probably saw it and were like, all right, this is where I draw the line with these stupid movies that are ripping off Evil Dead. Okay, so let me try to wrap this up. There's just so much great stuff in it. Basically, they find a book, of course, in the cabin, and two daggers, because Evil Dead had one dagger, so this one's got two. And apparently, when you use the dagger on a demon, it disappears. So you can only use it the one time. So they use it on one demon, boom, disappears. They use it on a second demon, which is one of them that turns into a demon. And they stab him, and then he becomes his human self, and then he becomes his self at 12, then he becomes a baby, and then he becomes a dove that flies away.
Whoa.
Oh. Okay.
And then there's a conclusion where the main guy says a spell and becomes like he looks like an alien to fight the main demon from the cover of the box. This movie is the most exciting thing that's happened to me in a long time.
And it's funny because I have one like that in a couple of minutes that I felt similar. Really? So it's going to be one of those good shows.
And here's the funny thing about it. So we watched and we're like, all right, well, that was something, right? And ever since, it's been like 5 days now. Yeah. Every day, Josh texts me new GIFs. And I'm like, how does this movie have this many GIFs?
Oh, crazy.
That create like of every radical thing I just told
He's making them.
No, he can't. From what? From a DVD?
Oh, you go on Tumblr. They're definitely
there. He keeps sending me them like at random. And I'm like, how does Demon Wind have this many GIFs in the world?
I can't remember. What's the name of the Lance Henriksen movie from the 80s that's got all the birds in it? It's like totally batshit and makes no sense.
Oh, yeah. The Visitor. One of my favorites.
This sounds like
Of course it's one of your favorites.
I love that film. But that Visitor was kind of big budget. This looks like a kind of lower rent thing.
It is, but it still looks, because it was shot on film, it still has that appeal to it. Basically, what Beck was saying before, John Humphrey, who is our social media guy, he literally is like, he summed it up so perfect. He's like, oh, like old trauma versus new trauma.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, oh, that's totally perfect. It. Because old trauma still looks like a real movie.
Yeah.
Whereas
things on film,
modern stuff doesn't. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what it is.
But that's one of those VHSs at one of those swap meets I almost bought, but it was like too expensive. So I just didn't do it.
Yeah, I've seen that cover so many times and I always like almost rented it and never did. So.
Greatest segue you'll ever have. I was about to say, speaking of magicians. So this was like the perfect setup. I watched Terror Train for the first time, which literally one of the main people in this film is David Copperfield.
Yes.
As a magician in this movie. This is just one of those slashes I'd never seen.
There's a musician in it as well.
Yeah, it was a question at trivia.
Yeah, I can't remember her name now. We need Jeff Nelson
here. Yeah, we do. But David Copperfield is pretty amazing and pretty sexually just something you can't take your eyes off. He just is kind of mesmerizing. I see why he's so good at magic. You just want to watch David Copperfield.
You're going to give him the yellow handkerchief.
Yeah, I will. But it's an interesting. This is just one of those few slashers. There aren't many now, I feel, that were totally under my radar at the time that you'd heard of because Jamie Lee's in it. But I just hadn't seen it. This is the Scream Factory Blu-ray. It's a lot of fun. I think the masks are really cool.
Because they change throughout.
Yeah, the killer keeps changing it. You know, there's a little magic involved.
We actually did a poll on the website probably a year ago for which Terror Train mask was, I think, the scariest.
There's an old face that when Jamie Lee kind of is captured at the end, and there somebody basically keeps attacking her. She's stuck in this little cage. It's pretty scary. And Roger Spottiswood is the director of the film, and Roger Spottiswood was also an editor for people like Peckinpah and had really a high profile. So it was not like it doesn't feel like a cheapy indie slasher. It actually feels pretty big budget on the scale that they're actually on a train. You have Ben Johnson, who's an Academy Award winning actor, as this older guy who has a lot of screen time. So it doesn't feel just like a teen slasher. I'm talking about Terror Train. Robbie, which I'm sure you've seen, right?
Oh,
yeah, I'd never seen it. So, you missed the segue, which is magicians.
Oh,
David Copperfield. So, going from your
pat
phone,
you in the back.
Yeah, exactly. I was excited.
Well done, sir. Well done.
And if I haven't given it away, Rob left the room.
Just stuck
and then came back.
Because you missed all that. Anyway, I thought it was a pretty good movie. I thought the ending led to something actually kind of exciting, but up until then, you know, it was so-so.
Stand-up little slasher.
But now I will go to the one. Look, some people have accused me of superlatives before. especially Rob. But this movie is the best movie I've ever seen in my entire life. Night of a Thousand Cats. I had never seen Night of a Thousand Cats.
Okay.
And when I watched it, I'd been trying to see it for a couple of years. And my friend had the Code Red DVD, which Code Red Bill Poole, he pulled it off because it was on a double with some other movie that everyone complained because it was out of order. Yeah, big deal. The movie was out of order because the reels were put together wrong. And he released it and everyone got mad at him. So he said, fuck you all, I'm pulling it, or some story like that. But Night of a Thousand Cats remained in perfect condition on this disc. And this is a movie by Rene Cardona Jr. who made Tintorera and a Guyana film. I knew it would be funny and like a holy fucking shit.
As in like the crappy shark movie?
Crappy, okay. I don't know.
I think it's a classic.
It's strong sharksploitation.
This is where Tarantino took Hugo Stiglitz, the character name, because there's an actual actor, Hugo Stiglitz. And what's funny in this movie, this is a guy with a perfect beard, dark sunglasses, and basically lots of shots of him just looking cool. But what I realized halfway through this movie is they must have stolen his identity for those Heineken commercials, or is it Corona, the most interesting man in the world?
That would be...
I think it's Corona, right?
No, hold on. Guys, what is the most interesting?
Dos Equis,
thank you.
The Dos Equis guy is exactly this Hugo Stiglitz character. Basically, every shot he's with a different hat, scantily clad woman. But the coolest thing about this movie, it's literally a movie about a guy who just cruises around in his helicopter, and he like takes the helicopter down anytime he sees a hot girl and says, hey, come with me. He doesn't even talk. He just waves with his cool sunglasses, and they always go with him pretty much. They go to his like, he has this weird little island castle thing that only this kind of Igor type character is waiting for him. He's very modern. He takes them inside. Hey, baby, come in here. You see literally 1,000 starving cats behind this weird fenced wall, and you're like, okay, that's pretty crazy. And then you start to realize he takes the girls there to feed him to the cats, and occasionally take their heads and put them in a glass case. This movie is 64 minutes long.
now we're talking.
It feels like 3 hours of just wonderful.
Well, Elric, I'm looking at it on Wikipedia right
now. You need to buy all the copies.
According to Wikipedia, the box office take on this movie was $350 million.
What? Wow, yeah. Well, it's probably accurate.
There's no fucking way.
in pesos. That could be. But no, this movie's like, I'm definitely not pulling your leg. This movie was, I could see how some people might not like it, but if you saw this with people, I was like, my mouth was hanging open because there's something so cool about this guy, Hugo Stiglitz, who's also one of the guys in Tintorera. I can't even
Tintorera.
Say it. If you can find the copy of this, I swear you should buy it. I will give you your money back because one of my goals is to collect all the copies of this. I would love to be the only person who has this movie, and you have to come to me to watch this movie. That's how special this movie was. And this is the only birthday present I received. Somebody actually gave me the copy of this movie.
Wow.
Because he got two when Code Red Bill pulled them. He bought two for that reason. And so I have this movie. So if you want to do a screening night.
Well, some interesting things that I've just learned about this. It was mostly released under the name Blood Feast.
Okay.
Yeah, like that's what it's listed as.
Who wants to watch that and not Night
of a
Thousand
Cats? I know,
Night
of a Thousand Cats. But apparently there was heavy controversy because of the cruel treatment of cats.
Whatever, there's a lot of cats. I mean, I've got two cats.
It wasn't like Mick Garris with Sleepwalkers back then, guys. It's an exploitation film.
Actually, that might be a good warning, like Cannibal Holocaust. There might be some people who can't handle it. You don't see any torture to them. The cats kind of...
Apparently,
the cats get their own on the people. Let me put...
Apparently, he throws a large white cat.
In his defense, it is in slow motion. Okay, so you know the cats probably ended up fine. I don't know. Anyway, brilliant movie.
Wow,
it really made my whole trip. Wow. I mean, I'm in New York City, but I'm at somebody's house watching that, going, "This made my trip." Like that was it for me. And I've heard there's a longer version, and like on YouTube, where there's like 20 minutes put back. You don't want those 20 minutes. You want the lean, mean
64 minutes.
I think that explains how he gets all the talks to them. You don't want that. You just want a guy with a helicopter picking up ladies.
It's
kind of special.
Oh my god.
And then let me just. Wrap you the two. I saw Tribeca because that was, you know, why I was there. I saw Ben Wheatley's Free Fire, not really horror, so I'm not gonna talk too much. I will just
I've heard
say
it's really good though.
It's brilliant for the first like. The first 45 minutes might be my favorite movie of the year, and it's just hard to maintain, man. It's like the whole movie is a gunfight. The whole concept is to keep the 2-hour movie or a 90-minute movie, and it's just one orchestrated gun battle. And it's just this is a movie made by a guy. You know how sometimes you're like, oh, this is a guy he thought he was going to make that one movie. This is made by a guy who probably thinks he's going to make 40 more movies. He's like, I got one idea. Yeah, let's make it. And he makes this big movie. He's going to make 40 more of them. What does he give a shit? I thought it was really interesting, but it does like certainly by the end to me, it kind of petered out because the story isn't really there to maintain it. Yeah. But in terms of characters, it's a total blast at the start. The two I saw, one I won't say much at all about, Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead's new film is called The Endless. It's a totally engaging mind bender of a movie. It feels very much like Outer Limits would be the closest thing I could compare it to that I've seen. The problem is there is it's just like, don't read anything about this movie. Everyone's going to ruin it for you. There's something about it that is so fun to discover for yourself that it will stop me from basically saying anything, except I really enjoyed it. I thought it was interesting. I was very hesitant because they cast themselves as the two leads.
That's what I was going to ask you about.
Okay, yeah. It's completely for a very, very, very specific reason.
Wow.
Tied to them as filmmakers and connected to basically their filmography. And that is like what the movie, it's not, these aren't twists that will like ruin the movie, but it's a nice thing to discover. But I have no idea if you hadn't like watched any of their films, how this film will play. I think I saw somebody from Blumhouse was there and they hadn't seen anything and really enjoyed it. But for me, it felt so tied into what they do.
Oh, was Olivia there?
Yeah, I think that's who it was. Yeah, they came up to me after. Really interesting movie though. I think it builds on the idea that these guys, I mean, Spring's still to me the best movie. Like, it just stands alone as such an interesting, evocative movie.
I love Resolution.
But and I think Resolution plays into this. It's just their ideas are so great and they're still being super independent with their ideas. But the film for me that it's going to be one of my favorites of the year, but it's hard, you might find it hard to believe because these are written by friends of mine, but they made the film Siren. This movie couldn't be any more different than Siren. This is like 180 degrees different film called Super Dark Times. A guy I went to film school with was the director, Ben Collins and Luke Petrowski, who I've talked about before on the show, and hopefully we'll get guests. Yeah. Luke and Ben, you know from Trivia.
Yeah, Luke comes
he's my
to trivia.
Neighbor. They told me years ago, they've had like four movies made now. Stephanie is going to be the Blumhouse one opening the Overlook Fest. They wrote that. They told me a long time ago, this is the movie that you're going to like. They always go, this is the one Elric's going to like. They were really nervous that I wasn't going to like this before. And I even said to them, hey, if you don't see me after, I'm running because I don't want that pressure. It was the first screening of my whole life, I swear to God, where I saw something that my friends had made that I walked out of theater feeling more inspired than I've ever felt, more excited for them. The voices of these, you're going to love it, I think, Rob, because it's basically Stand By Me in a slightly grittier, more darker version of Stand By Me. And the voices are so real to teenagers. I couldn't even believe it. It's just hilarious. Wow. It's Stranger Things too. It's like 4 years later, Stranger Things, like because it's kids on bikes hanging out and then something bad happens and it's what happens after the bad thing happens. They're all dealing with trying to kind of cover up how it affects their lives in very different ways. But really it's about being a young male teenager and the way they've written these character voices it's really special. It's the first film I felt that way since when I saw February in a theater and in terms of a spell being cast and I'm in the movie. I'm just totally there. And I say that, with the caveat that I know these guys, but I didn't feel that way at certain other films. I even told them after Siren, I was like, yeah, it's pretty good. I like it. It's fun, but it's not my kind of movie. Mm-hmm. This is totally my kind, but I actually, for some reason, think you'll particularly enjoy it because of the age and it's set in the 90s. So it's kind of fun.
I'm in.
Yeah. It's like Bill Clinton's on TV. There's some old bad porn they're stealing from the next door neighbor's HBO and a bad satellite,
Yeah.
But this is a movie to really keep your eyes out. I think it's going to probably be, it's The Orchard bought it.
Nice.
I think it might be an October release. It's, fringe horror, thriller, dark film. I know I saw a lot. That's 10 films I saw this week while I was away.
Good God.
But yeah. Tribeca, Tribeca is a very kind of a button-up kind of film. Not necessarily my kind of film festival, if you know what I mean. It's a little too urban and chic. It's not like going to South By where you have an experience as a viewer. I'm sure if you're a filmmaker, you're getting a great experience. But it was just like going to the movies in New York City. But it was still cool. And thanks to Matt Barone, again, he hosted both the Q&As and listens to our show.
Nice.
I had a great time. And yeah, look out for those movies.
I will fly through the last few, but I definitely want to talk about the book I read. So I've mentioned The Magicians. We're back to Magicians.
Oh, God.
The TV show that I was watching because it was streaming on Netflix. Well, I got so addicted to it that I'm now on the second season, which I broke down and paid for because I couldn't handle having to wait for it to come to Netflix. Still absolutely loving the show. And I know after I talked about it, a couple people messaged me on Twitter like, right? No one is watching this that I can talk about with it. It is so good. So I highly recommend checking out The Magicians. The first season is streaming on Netflix now. I wrote this down just to tell you, Elric, before one of the movies I saw this week, I don't remember which one it was, there was a big trailer for the re-release of Stalker. which they are doing a theatrical run for. So you and I have to go see it, because even just the trailer, when they were showing some of the scenes up on the screen, it just looked absolutely amazing.
I wonder who's putting, I mean, I know Criterion's putting out the disc. I wonder who's putting it in the theaters.
I can't remember who. I saw a couple of different things this week because I was doing some press screenings, and everything from like Boss Baby to, I don't think it was before Boss Baby.
Probably wasn't before Boss Baby.
I don't think it was before, but it may have been before the Transfiguration now that I'm thinking about it, because I remember a bunch of art things. I think maybe Kino Loiber, I want to guess. Could be. Maybe. I'll have to look that up. But yeah, so Stalker's coming back. So I just had to plug that one for you. But the big one that I wanted to talk about was last week I had read, and again, I'm going to chew these pronunciations, Goyo, G-Y-O, which is the Junji Ito novel about fish that kind of just start walking on land one day. When we were talking about it last week, Ryan was like, oh yeah, I really want to read his book, Dissolving Classroom. And as soon as Ryan showed me a couple of pictures from it on his phone, I was like, I want to read this too. So literally the next morning I ordered it. It was Amazon Prime. I had it like the next day and I read the entire thing. This book is fucking nuts.
It's backwards.
Well, it's manga. It's like, going to be backwards. But yeah, it's an anthology in that it's kind of broken up into chapters, and each one is kind of about the same siblings, but it goes through different towns that they're forced to move to. So it's a brother and little sister. And the little sister is possessed by a snake and eats brains. The brother worships the devil, and somehow through apologizing, he brings about the devil's power and causes people's brains to melt out their nose. Now, at first, it seems like you just have a cold where you're like, I'm sniffly. What's all this junk coming out of my nose? But then you start losing your mind. And everything melts. And then your whole body melts. And it gets gruesome. Oh, cool. And I was a really big fan of Spiral just because Spiral was so surreal and macabre and kind of twisted. This is just like straight up like Splatstick. It's definitely fun. And the art is really gruesome. So yeah, Dissolving Classroom, if you're into kind of like gory, weird, surreal, like it's not scary. It's just kind of like straight up like weird and gory.
Yeah, I've seen that cover image all over online.
Yeah, it's all over.
That's not one of the ones that was sent to us by listener?
No, no. I picked that up.
I forgot to bring those books.
Yeah, yeah. And so once I started posting that I'd finished Goyo and I just finished Dissolving Classroom, a couple people sent me some other of his books that I have to check out. So I'm just going to kind of work my way through everything now.
Looks very like cool. Screaming Mad George.
It feels like it. It really does have like a society feel to it. But at the same time, it's just, it's really gruesome, but fun.
Cool. Well, the last thing I wanted to mention was a double feature I caught at the New Beverly. Really excited about this. They showed The Abominable Dr. Fibes, which is probably one of my favorites with Vincent Price, paired up with The House That Dripped Blood. Mm-hmm. And that's cool because we had Darren Scott on to talk anthologies a few weeks back. And that was an anthology he brought up that I had not seen. And just proving that we are in a Matrix-like world, 2 days later, they announced they're showing it at the New Bev. So I'm like, oh, I have to go see it. So this is a great double bill. I mean, I've always loved Dr. Fives. They had a beautiful 35mm print of it. And to see with an audience, it's really, for the time period, it's 1971. It's pretty graphic. I mean, it's a revenge story, obviously. It's like he's this deformed doctor who lost his wife. And he blames several surgeons for being responsible for the death of his wife. So then in very intricate ways, using some sort of, Egyptian sort of curse
Isn't
deal.
Isn't it the plague?
Yeah, he's using the plague.
He's using the plagues to and it was funny because my friend Blake Riegel was there and he came up to me. He's like, oh man, I liked it. He's like, I didn't know this was a Saw movie. And I'm like, pretty much. It's pretty much Jigsaw. But it's a beautiful movie, and I still love it. And House of Drip Blood was really good, too. It was written by Robert Block, who obviously wrote Psycho. I didn't realize that he'd done quite a couple of these. This and Asylum as well. But this was a lot of fun. It was, I think, technically four skits, although I guess the fourth was the wraparound, as they do, turns into the fourth one, which I really love. And it's basically a detective gets called in a town because of these weird occurrences at this house. So it's like the house that, you know, is the culprit behind these messed up things that happened there. And I really love the first skit, which was kind of about an author that was writing about a strangler. And then the strangler kind of comes to life. He keeps seeing him around the house. And then he's like nervous that he's going to kill his wife and stuff. But what's fun about this, and I don't want to give him away because it's just fun to watch it this way, is It almost, and it was funny to watch with an audience. So the second skit, the lead of it is Peter Cushing. So he like walks into frame, everyone starts cheering. Then that skit ends, Christopher Lee walks into frame. Yeah. And you're like, all right, he's the lead of this one. So you get all these like icons. And then I think it was the fourth skit that's, I forget the name of the guy, but it's an actor who is playing a vampire in something. And he's like, he's mocking Hollywood. And he's like, you know, nothing's like the classics. You know, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, Dracula, Bela Lugosi, of course, not that other guy. And that got the biggest laugh because obviously we had just seen Christopher Lee 5 minutes ago in the previous skit. So
is this the one with the poster? Is Peter Cushing's head on the platter?
Yes, that's the one. It's pretty good. It's not one of the best anthologies I saw, but there was that first skit really stood out a lot to me, and I thought it was really cool, and that was definitely the way to see it. And I, like you in New York, a gentleman named Perry came up and said hello to me. He was a listener of the show, which I thought was really sweet. So it was a good way to watch movies with like-minded souls, if you will.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah, five. You know what? I got to revisit the sequel to that because I have not
five
seen that for
again.
A long time.
I remember
time.
Liking that one a lot.
Which one? Five?
Five Rides. There's again. A sequel. That it doesn't have Cotton. Joseph Cotton's in the first one, right? He's the detective.
In
the first
but
one.
It's still Vincent Price.
It might be Peter Cushing in the sequel, who's the other lead. I can't recall, but I haven't seen that for a long time. And I think it's the same director. We should watch that.
I remember it being slightly gorier than the first one.
Yeah, all right. We had the writer of the first one. No, it was the same director who did both.
Scroll down and there's Cushing in it?
Of which one?
This one.
Five Brides
Cushing
Again.
In the second?
Robert Quarry. And Peter Cushing.
I got to revisit that one.
Yeah, I want to re-see that one too.
First one's just beautiful. It's a beautiful looking movie.
Yeah, it really is.
And smart.
I remember it being poetic and smart, like it actually being kind of a touching story.
Well, because he's a good villain, you know, because it's out for revenge and he has a good reason. You know,
yeah,
and it's,
very
it's
much
easy
so.
To cheer for that kind of character, you know.
Yeah.
And Price is best when he gets to just go.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know what? The thing that impressed me most about it, and I mean, this isn't a spoiler, but he doesn't speak for at least 25 minutes. And then when he does speak, it's something off because, you know, I don't want to reveal it, but he uses a little mic thing on his, on the side. But that's the thing is the acting he does the whole movie without physically speaking is just amazing. Can tell.
It's almost like he's better with a limitation.
He's great that way. So
it's very cool.
So that was that. Was there anything else you saw, Becca?
Nope, I'm good.
All right.
So just a couple movies.
Just a couple.
just a couple.
That's what happens when we miss a week or one of us misses a week.
So we're going to take a quick break in here from our sponsor, and then we're going to bring a guest on. And this is very exciting. Somebody that I've always wanted to have on the show because I've worked with him quite a lot over the years. And for a lot of you, I know how much you love the kind of the behind the scenes on the Blu-ray companies, like when we have Scream Factory or Twilight Time or any of these people on. As of this listening, you will see a photo that I'm going to post on the group the day before of just 90% of the titles this guy has worked on. But
and even bigger than that, he was the most consistent customer of Jump Cut Cafe. like literally the person keeping me alive at the end.
So we're going to be back with Unsung Hero Jim Koons in just a minute.
Today's sponsor is Shudder, the premium streaming video service devoted to horror, thrillers, and suspense. Backed by AMC Networks, Shudder has a growing and dynamic selection of thrilling premieres, originals, and exclusives, including Rob Zombie's 31, The Ring vs. The Grudge franchise matchup, Sadako vs. Kyoko, and We Are the Flesh. Shudder is also the only place to find legendary BBC film Ghostwatch, now available in the USA for the first time ever. Shudder is available on the web, ISO, Android, Chromecast, Apple TV, and Roku for $4.99 a month or $49.99 for an annual membership. But Shockwave listeners can get a free month by entering the promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of horror available to stream anywhere.
All right, and we are back with our very, 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 very special guest, just because I want to make him feel comfortable.
He's done so much.
This is the thing.
Like,
you guys—
Oh, we also like him.
We do like him. We do like him a lot. You guys, you actually know and have seen so much of this guy's work because he's worked on so many titles that we've mentioned and that you've bought on top of a lot of other cool stuff like working with Elvira and making films in his own right. So we are thrilled to have Mr. Jim Koons in the studio.
Jim Koons!
Jim.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
All righty.
So, ma'am.
I was worried my voice was going to be a little too high.
It's kind of falling out right now.
That was an in-between joke.
Yes, and while I'm sitting here, I mean, like, we just got done talking about the brain damage Blu-ray coming up, and I'm seeing you worked on that.
Yes.
You did a couple of the different segments on that, animating Elmer and the listening to light.
What have you not worked
damage
on? That's probably the easier way to
get it. Let's get it out of the way. I don't really work with Synapse that much, although I have on a few of the things through Michael Felscher's Red Shirt Pictures, and I don't really do anything with Twilight Time.
Right.
Although
they don't really do features.
Is that what it is? I've never even bought one. Everyone's just like, I know they do a limited amount and then it's like $60 or something crazy.
Yes.
Is that,
it's not 60. It's usually retails 40. For 30.
And no. They don't do a lot of horror.
$29.99. Yeah. They don't really do horror.
Not that many. So
very limited, which is why people immediately jack them and put them on eBay for double the price. But
yeah, maybe that's it. I'm not here to give any kind of factual information whatsoever. Let's get that out of the way right now.
Well, Jim, we have a Twilight Time episode that explains everything.
Yeah. It's on our Killer POV.
We're going to advertise that for the next episode.
Yeah. Do we want to go back to the beginning? I was going to say, how did you get started doing features? But we should go back further, shouldn't we?
God, where do we start?
Little Jim. Tell us about Little Jim.
No, actually, I don't want to hear about Little Jim.
I worked in a liquor store when I was in fourth grade. And I had like a 357 waved in my... I grew up in South Pasadena over here.
Wait, South Pass was like hardcore at the time?
No, not at all. There's a little place called Foremost Liquor. It was like down the street. I lived on Monterey Road. And I just started hanging out there. I was a latchkey kid. My mom was always out running around doing whatever. And my brother didn't care. He was older than me. So I would just hang out. They would give me money and I learned like we would tap the phones outside. I learned all about life through like working at this liquor store, and then it got robbed and my mom got weirded out, but she didn't care that I went back the next night. It was, if you really want to go back that far, it has nothing to do with anything, but
That's crazy. I'm still just trying to picture like liquor store in South Pasadena because it seems very like pristine and clean to me. South Pass is really nice for those who don't live in LA.
It is really nice.
But you're talking about being like a 10-year-old?
However old I was. I don't know. I would just hang out there and eventually like, well, let's just give this little shit won't leave. Let's give him, here's $20. Go stock the cooler. We don't want to do it. Wow. And I would do it. And eventually I would just hang out there and I would leave with money. And then I would go to grade school. Like, what do you do when you get money when you're a kid? I would like, what
malt
better
liquor.
Buy? Yo, I would buy all the now and laters and bring them to school and try to buy. Cause I didn't know. I was even weird. I never really had a lot of friends. So it's like, oh, I'll buy my friends. I have stuff. So it was misfired
from
the start.
Did you sell the now and laters in high
No,
school?
I would give them out. I would skip through the hall throwing candy on my backpack, like some little candy fairy. Like,
because that, by the way, that was a big market in my high school. Is kids would buy like, you know, the what are those long Sour Patch like the strings or whatever? They go and buy them and then sell them for like, you know, buy them for 5 cents and sell them for a quarter at school. There's like a big ring of like, we didn't have drugs, we were doing candy.
Jim didn't have that business acumen. But he's just handing out for
money. But here's the thing, and this may be
a vending machines.
No,
not South Pass, but a
common thread that will run through all of this is that one of the reasons I am, and each of you know me in a different capacity already, I'm not motivated by money, and I never have been.
Never.
It's always been very easy for me to make money and get myself to be needed through technology or whatever skill set I've learned, and I've just never been motivated by that. I've realized very early on that like people like stuff. And it's if you do things for people, they're going to like you and they're going to be nice to you and they're going to need you. So that's always been kind of my motto is make people need me.
Right.
And that's where, if you want to go back to where it started, that's how it was with William Lustig. I got started with Blue Underground, and I basically, he needed a new website, and I was doing internet stuff. I don't know if I'm jumping all over the place.
You're doing fine.
Well, let's start there. Because I mean, did you always have, because that's the thing is like, you are kind of a jack of all trades, for lack of a better term, and a one-man machine. Like when you show up to shoot this stuff, you know every aspect of production pretty much and how to get this stuff done quickly, cheaply, and efficiently. And it all starts from kind of web design, like at least, you know, as you were about to say. So did you always have – what was that about you that you were on top of the web before things became necessary? Like you were doing web design before people needed websites.
Yeah, but it was even before that. I was DJing. I was doing like mixing like raves with like record and playing techno. I was obsessed with it. And so I did that in the early 90s, but I quickly saw like this is a loser route. Like I would talk to the people I was with like, what do you guys want to be doing in 10 years? And they're like, bro, throwing the sickest parties. I'm like, nah, you're going to be doing weddings and shit. It's not going to really go the way you plan. But I learned – I liked the mechanics, like the board we're looking at right here and all that. I loved that. I loved the technology. I loved knobs and dials and analog. So I got in, I saw the internet forming. And I was like, this is what I want. So I got rid of all the DJ stuff. I sold it. I bought a little Mac Plus back in the day. And I just like obviously bought the wrong machine. But I learned quickly about hardware, the internet technology. I went and got certified with Microsoft for networking. I think it's called like a Microsoft Certified System Engineer. And I would do that. This is so boring for anyone listening.
No.
It's going to become cool.
I just said Microsoft Certified System Engineer on your
on
horror broadcast.
Shockwave.
Like, yeah.
But Halton Catch Fire is very popular. So some of these TV shows about nerdy shit work. So. Yeah.
But anyway, it was that. I learned very early on like how to do networking and how I would work. I worked with places like airline companies and learned how to connect to the airline servers to the tickets. It's all done very easily now, but back then it was specific hardware boxes and specialty, and I got really into that. And I got bored very fast with that too, because it's boring. You go to someone's office, you set everything up and make it work, and then you're not doing anything because it all works. And right. So like, oh, like, well, she can now print from Word and this person can do that. And so I just eventually like design looks fun and the internet's forming and pages don't have to look ugly. I don't remember what like Yahoo and all that looked like back in the day, but it was awful.
Yeah.
Programmers cannot design. And so I learned programming and design because I saw that's what's missing. Designers don't know anything about code and this and that. So I would do that. Mm. Mix it around. Hopefully you can edit this. Cut all this down.
No, but it's all in
well, what's interesting, but you are, see, it's, I don't have that at all. They're like, the, yeah. you're, that no, thing this, about wanting to touch technology.
Well, that's
and
it.
Yeah.
And,
this,
and the reason I wanted to bring this up is because it plays into your work ethic that I've learned over the years is that, I mean, Jim is the tech guy. If you have any fucking issue with anything, whether it's a computer, shooting, editing, whatever, you can call him and he'll get back to you right away, solve it. And I'll be like, how did you do that? I was like, I just like Googled it and figured it out.
Immediately.
Like, how?
I have asked him so many questions about codecs. I've asked you about DCPs before when I was struggling to like get one of those made and then it was dropping frames. Shit that I just, for lack of a better, I don't care about. Like I love making films and I love the product, but when it's like, my DCP is dropping frames. I'm like, I don't care. Just make it work. Why won't it work?
Well, see, most people would be boring in that context. Yes. And you're not boring. And also, but you're also a horror fan before all of this.
Yes.
Like from a young age. So I do want to, touch on that before because, and then connect it to the technology because it feels like these two streams are going to collide
right.
in a very interesting way.
They are.
So take us back. Horror early.
Because just to jump forward, as of now, I'm the technical director for a lot of the, like Blue Underground, Severin Films, Grindhouse Releasing.
My favorite of all, Grindhouse Releasing. Love those.
And again, it's like we kind of, exhausted his library.
Right. No,
there's
I know.
A couple more
know.
Coming up, but it's like, that's Murawski. That's
that could be it. Like the collection. Yeah.
We spent 9 months making pieces. You know what I mean? Like the
that's
amount
such
of
a Murawski thing.
Right. Yeah. But again, it's like a disc of the year for some of these things.
Beyond,
I'm like,
that Beyond disc is
amazing.
Next level.
Yep.
I mean, yeah.
And then we did the Duke Mitchell movies. Nobody cared. Those got so much love.
I got the poster up in my living room.
I love that you have that.
I hung a painting
of
it in Jump Cut for like 2 years, and it's still my favorite, the thing I miss most.
Yeah. But when it came time for like all the top 10 list, I was like, finally, the Duke Mitchell, it was a lost film, Gone with the Pope, nobody cared. I was just like, man. But I worked on all the other so
I think Gone
matter.
With the Pope will still have it today. I feel like it's going to happen. It's such a special movie.
Anyway, again, I'm all over the place. You guys
But that's fine because I think we're all kind of a little bit like that. And you know, we looked at – there was an email that went around of all the things you've done just to catch us up. And I remember that you ended it in a way that actually I thought was pretty poignant to the three of us, which is, you know, you do this for cinema. You do this – for your, you know, not to make money, and you said something like, and you guys know what that is because you're all doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. We've been doing a podcast for 4 years. You know, we're not doing this for money. We don't do it. We do this out of a fucking passion to talk about this stuff, to share it, to like indulge it, and to still live as young people, like as kids who first fell in love with something. But I just want to know, like, because in that same email you were talking about, you know, you're a horror fan from an early age. So like, just walk us through how that you got the bug. What, do you remember like the earliest horror you saw and what got you turned on?
The one that got me the most was, it's such a dumb story. It was House by the Cemetery.
Oh, yeah.
And I lived in an apartment building in South Pasadena, and the kid that lived in the building, we said, hey, we're going to the movie. Let's go. So we went to the Highland Park 3, but they were going to see Bo Derek Bolero. And they're like, oh, these kids can't go in there. You guys go watch one of the other two. So House by the Cemetery. So we went and watched that.
Wait, House by the Cemetery was okay, but Bolero was not?
That's like Chuck Norris. Like, violence is fine. Do not show a tit.
Wow. Like, okay. That's crazy. I always thought House by the Cemetery was pretty extreme.
I was sixth grade when that happened. I had seen some before, but that was the one that really kind of broke me.
Because it's different, right?
It's so different. The atmosphere, I'd never seen anything like that. I've obviously had watched a lot of stuff on television, Night of the Living Dead, like it creeped out. They would show it on TV. But that was the one, the atmosphere was weird. The reels were out of order, I learned later.
Well, you might not be able to tell because it's glitchy. So it's like stream of conscious dream anyway.
But people die And then they come back. And so I was just like, this shit is surreal.
So it's like Beyond.
Exactly. So. Yeah. I don't, like you said, I didn't know if it was intentional or not. So that was the one. I remember I was in sixth grade and I had a creative writing class and I wrote this awful story about eyeballs getting ripped out and gut, you know, just I was so moved by what I saw there. That they were like, you got to see the principal. Something's wrong with this child. So,
were you the same age as Bob when you saw that?
No, I think Bob's a little older. Bob. Yeah, right, little voice. I wish that's how mine sounds.
Well, I mean, I can only imagine because, like, yeah, Night of the Living Dead's one thing, but to see something as dreamy as Fulci, it does take movies like that to really infect your mind because you don't understand it. Not understanding something is much more terrifying, mm-hmm. you know, especially when you're young. Your brain's trying to figure it out. Like, oh, there's nudity. And then something awful happens, that nudity. I don't understand. I don't like that, but I want to watch more of it. I find that interesting.
There's a real estate agent that gets a poker stuck into her. Yes. It's such a good effect.
Yeah.
And this is all great because we can talk about, I went to Rome and interviewed everybody and did the Blu-ray for it. So I got to actually, you know.
Oh, you were part of our favorite story of all time, the Murawski
Beyond the Beyond.
And talking to the writer.
Yeah. Yep.
And sitting in the editing room as they were trying to, you know, get them to do regraining, was it?
I wasn't there for that one.
Okay. No. Murawski spoke about how they were trying to get them to kind of, you know, repair some of the damage that had been done to some of these films and that they were very much like, I don't have time for this. And that he was like, these are classic works of
That's
art.
Right. You're right.
They didn't care in Italy.
Yeah, they weren't treating it with the way it should be respected. But it's going to be hard not to jump all over because we also, just because that is my favorite episode of Killer POV was with Bob.
Murawski.
But a lot of the stories are shared with you.
The Bill Lustig one was amazing.
Exactly. Yeah, they're probably two of my favorites.
All right, so we are jumping around, but screw it.
My brain works that way. As part of the problem of being as technical is I'm a fucking spaz. I mean, it's all over the place at all times. It's a programmer brain. It's a weird video. It's a horror nerd. Brain. Yeah. It's all of these things in one.
Well, before we jump into the work, so House by the Cemetery, first movie that really had an impact on you. But then what about in terms of getting the filmmaking bug and learning about, you know, because was shooting being a cinematographer the thing you went for, or was there a different aspect of filmmaking?
I set out to direct them. I was like, I can make, it was like mid-2000s. I saw, like, I was already doing photography, After Effects, everything. I lived on a computer. And I said, video's now HD, and if I get it on my machine, I can pretty much do anything with the picture. I can color correct it, I can adjust it, I can comp, I can cut someone's head off without actually doing it. You know, you can do this stuff, and I realized that. But the movies that inspired me, The Dark Backward, Adam Rifkin's early one, I love it. Just simply, and that's one, even people that love the same movies as me, I'll loan them that DVD, and they're like, I don't know, this is not for me. But he made it $1 million, made it in Los Angeles. He created an entire world in the 30-mile zone, and it has atmosphere, and it's weird, and it's unique. There's something about it that I love it. Mm-hmm. And so that was one, Dead Alive, obviously, mm-hmm. Brain Dead. I love that. That's one that inspired me. I think I like when there's a drop of blood. I mean, there's a laugh with every drop of blood. You know what I mean? Mm. Sometimes it gets a little serious and too raw. It's hard for me to take it seriously. I don't really get scared.
Yeah.
And so it's funny a lot of times. So that's what I like. I love Creepshow. But the ones that really inspired me and were like, I can do this. I can make that. It was kind of those types of movies. Ones that really created an atmosphere or stand out on their own. I mean, I still don't think Dead Alive has been topped. Yeah. As far as just that lawnmower scene, it's so good in
sequences,
every way. Yeah. I was in San Diego in college watching that with a roommate, and when that ear thing happens and the guy's eating the guy's ear like in soup, he threw up. And I'm just like, that is so cool. Wow. Like, we're watching art at this point to me because it really affected him. He wasn't drunk or anything. So I just there's a few tentpole movies that for me are really important that most people don't care about, but those are the ones that really inspired me. And after I was getting really bored, I was making a lot of money. I lived in a 7-story house in out Washington by myself doing all this computer stuff. It was great, but it's just, what am I doing? I'm not happy. I still go to an office every day. I'm not that into it. I know I can do this stuff on my own. And so that's when it was 2007, January of 2007. I took a loan out from a credit union. I spent 20 grand on camera stuff and 20 grand on a big computer, like workstation. And I just set out to do it. I worked out of my house. I would still do web design, Bill Lustig's thing, do programming, motion graphics. I did Cheech and Chong roast on Comedy Central. I would just find weird jobs and just do them. And the big celebration day was like when I realized I haven't done anything off Craigslist in I think a year. I'm like, that's pretty cool. Craigslist is, you're definitely starting out. You're not getting paid for most stuff. Most things don't even happen. You don't really meet people that you'll work with later. So that was when I realized in about 2008 or 2009, like, oh, wow, this is, this is actually going pretty well. I'm making a little reputation for myself by just doing good work, knowing what I'm talking about, and don't be a dick and don't make it about me. Mm. It's always about what I'm doing. It's always, it's not, hey, here's Jim. It's, hey, here's the product. Here's this.
Right.
You're a closer.
That's the thing.
That's what I would call you, a closer. Because I think anyone could give you any task and you will actually deliver it. Unlike right. some yeah. people who won't
and,
have a clue.
And like I said it before you came on, unsung. Like you yeah. never take credit for this stuff.
Yeah.
So it's also about, you know, because Bill Lustig seems like the biggest segue into kind of the world and all the yeah. stuff you do now. Tell us about that. How did you first meet him and get the website going?
All right. There's a. I love Maniac. I've obviously Maniac Cop, Vigilante. I loved Bill's movies. I knew him. I'd never met him. And I worked at a company that this guy Andy Garoni was one of the partners in. Mm-hmm. And he was Bill's producing partner for Maniac and Vigilante and some of the early things. And I knew he then started Up Coast and did a lot of those '90s kind of Skinamax movies. So he knew I loved movies. And he kept the Maniac shotgun under his desk, the sawed off shotgun.
That is crazy.
Yeah. And we're like in Woodland Hills. Like nothing jumps off in Woodland Hills. You're gonna need wow. a sawed off shotgun under your desk, but. I think he just had it because it was cool. But he basically knew that I was going to kind of get out of what I was doing. And I hired someone to replace myself, a senior designer at the company we were at. And I said, look, I'm getting into film. I think I can do this. And he introduced me. He said, hey, Bill Lustig is needing a new website for Blue Underground. So why don't you go ahead and get in there and do that? And you'll probably segue into, I've always been, he knows, like you'll grow. He'll like you and you'll do more stuff. So that's kind of how that went. And I did the site. I updated every month. I handled the database. I handled everything for Bill. And then editing came up. So I started editing and, you know, I just literally lynda.com, that website, LYNDA.
Yeah.
I learned everything
all
on there.
All the tutorials on
yeah.
there.
Yeah. Premiere. Uh-huh. And when I started in 2000, when I bought all that stuff, they're like, you're not getting a Mac? I'm like, no, I've always been like a PC guy. Like I just more powerful and I can build yeah. it myself and this and that. They're like, you're going to die on the vine, man. You got to use Final Cut or you're not gonna be able to do it. And all those people are now coming to me being yeah. like, how do I do this in Premiere?
So wait, do you use Premiere still?
Absolutely. I haven't touched Avid.
I was going to say, like, most of the people I know switched over to yep. Avid because they quit updating Final Cut, and most of the industry goes Avid now.
Yep. But Premiere Pro is kind of
it's, oh, it's beautiful. I did it now, yeah. because I was shooting on Panasonic. So it was these P2 cards and MXF format yeah. that nothing could read. So I had special hardware that would let me just edit that directly in the timeline. And I loved Adobe. I've always been with them. I've been with Photoshop for like 20 years. It's such a, they're a good company. They're huge yeah. and they're awful, but the software that they've either made or acquired is amazing. So I stand by it. And the bounce back between After Effects and Premiere, again, very exciting for your listeners, but the bounce back, the
there's
dynamic.
Like one guy
do you
going,
do
oh
smoke
my God.
As well?
I do, actually.
You do smoke? Wow, absolutely. That's like a crazy hard program
that's
to learn.
Because well, those are the professors. Flame, yeah. Nuke, and Smoke. And Smoke is barely even used at this point, I believe.
Okay.
I think they
we had on. Smoke when we were doing Fango TV, and I played on it briefly and was like, well, I don't know how to do this. And that was the end of that. So yeah.
running circles around.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, again, it's once you know, again, if you master Photoshop or you master Flash, I was really good in Flash. I yeah. loved scripting and all that. But once you know Flash, you kind of know After Effects. You just don't know it yet. But when you look at the interface and you start treating like, oh, they're kind of the same. And so I was having trouble with After Effects at first. And then my friend said, hey, you know Flash, why don't you look at it like that? And I did. And I said, oh, this is right. This is this is just Photoshop that moves. This is amazing. So it's once you know one, it's a lot. Same with programming languages. Once you know PHP, you can move to the next one pretty easily.
You could make millions of dollars, I think, by being like the guy who teaches people on YouTube how to do this. Like
yeah.
these little lessons with that kind of energy, I think people would watch that shit.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, guys. Jim here.
Jim
Coons. Because honestly, I run a website. I'm not that into code, but you're making it sound far more interesting. Code for me is
sexy code.
All right,
with
Jim. Let's start our coding show.
I will talk all night.
Seriously, Rob and I do this every day on the website, but code is just like the means to the end for me. Like, why does my font look stupid? What did I do wrong? Oh God!
No, but
now
this will be
with
the difference.
This.
It's like welcome to the coding show with Jim Coons, special guest Bill Lustig. Oh hi! I don't know much about code, but and you're like, what the fuck is this?
No, I love that stuff. We can get. I'm into cryptocurrencies now and all this stuff. We can talk crazy if you guys want, but we should probably focus on.
Oh
all right,
my
right.
God!
Let's get back to
keep okay. your pants on.
Yes.
So Blue Underground was the first company of this sort that you started doing stuff for. You yep. got a relationship with Bill Lustig. Start doing his features, you know, for his stuff. At what point did somebody else reach out to you? Because I assume through Lustig you got to Murawski. And
actually, no. That's interesting. But David okay. Gregory with Severin Films, he's right. the one I met through Bill. David actually came up with the name Blue Underground. I was about to burp. I didn't want to do it in the microphone. That would have been lovely.
That's what he did. No, I think I remember. About, yeah, I remember
I've heard that
yeah.
David was over
he
there.
He worked
yeah.
for him for a long time.
Yeah, so that he actually came up with the name Blue Underground. Yeah. And Bill said, hey, I want to use that. I love that. But it was natural. It naturally grew. As I started shooting featurettes and editing and stuff with Bill – it would kind of spread out. And then David's like, oh, hey, who's your guy? Can I use him? And you kind of meet them and become friends. Because David worked for Blue Underground forever prior to Severin. Mm-hmm. So I shouldn't say forever. I have no idea how long. But it's so incestuous. You know, the horror world in particular.
The horror world, it is.
Wait, so David was the one who led you to Bob Murrow?
No, that's a total separate. Since I owned all my equipment, I would basically just go shoot things. I'd be like, there's a Demons 2 panel at the New Beverly tonight, and like nobody's filming this.
That's right.
I would just get my camera, my tripod, and show up. Usually Brian Quinn, great guy, would let me in for free. So, oh, Jim's here to shoot it. Sure. Get me a seat next to Clue in the front.
Yeah.
And then I'd film the Q&A, and then I'd just give it to him or keep it, whatever. Maybe nothing happens. Cine Family, I would do that everywhere just because, A, I'm getting into the movie for free. So I still wasn't making a lot of money at the time. Mm-hmm. I bought that stuff and I had to pay, you know, $800 a month, whatever my monthly payment was to on the loan. But I just saturated myself everywhere in stuff I love. Yeah. So I don't mind that I'm leaving my house at 7 o'clock at night to essentially work because I'm going to watch a movie and then I'm going to hear people talk about it and I love the movie. So why not? And not to mention, when the fuck is the next time these people are going to all be together? It's Demons 2. They're all getting old and it's
That's really smart, rare. Actually.
Yeah. So yeah, so why not shoot it? And I don't care. I will give it to someone. I wasn't even licensing the footage. I would just shoot it and people are like, dude, you should probably make money on this. I'm like, but whatever. It's there. It didn't cost me anything to do it. I don't want to sound like a dick.
No.
Because it's not like,
it's amazing.
I don't care about money. I live in a 7-story house. It's like, it's just, I genuinely hate money. I always have.
Yeah,
it sours friendships.
Yeah,
it sours.
No, I have no interest in it at all. Zero.
Like, well, you know what I mean, though. It's like, of course, you have to work for money. But my kind of thought on all of this has been, do what you love, and then it's not work, and then I don't care that I'm not making money. And people are like, man, you can't do that. You're ruining it for everyone else, or if you're undercutting them, or with this and that. I'm just having fun, man. I'm just worried about myself and learning this and meeting all these people and building my relationship with all these companies because I fucking love these movies.
Yeah.
When I bought all that stuff, I stopped collecting. I had no more media. I didn't buy games. I didn't buy movies. I didn't buy anything. I would just kind of leave it because I got to buy lenses and all this other stuff. So why not work on them? Then they'll send me copies for free. You know what I mean? It's like you get what you want and you figure out how to get it. But
Well, some money must have bought the damn Suspiria on your poster, which I think about on a daily basis.
Oh, my God.
That was
a giant original Italian Suspiria.
Yeah, how big is it? Because it's right outside your office door is this amazing Suspiria.
It's like pretty much like this thing behind me that everyone listening has no idea what
we call that a six sheet or something?
I would be speaking of ignorance. Wow. I don't know.
Something like that. It's you know, like three times the size of an American poster.
Yeah, that actually would be
I have a photo of it. I'll post it.
But it's gorgeous.
Lustig had that in his apartment in Hollywood, in his house down in
Oh, my gosh.
But he got a Maniac Cop 2 one. Uh-huh. And so he's like, oh, I got to move this out. So he was going to put it in the Blue Underground storage. And I'm like, can I have, like, let me get it. I'll reframe it. I would love. So he gave it to me. So I took it, had it reframed, and just put it in the foyer of my office. And it's lived there since.
Yeah, one day I'm going to do something like a job for you, and that's going to be payment. That's all I want for the rest of my life. I'm going to do whatever it is for free for you, and then that's going to be even though I still owe you for making a Hollywood Underground. He'd made the mastered all the films to this because no one else knew how the fuck to do it. He made a Blu-ray, like, overnight.
The day of, right?
Overnight. Yeah. And I just sent him all these random files, and he perfect.
You did the codex. That's what it is.
I did. No, I would do that all
for...
What's the Ethereum? I was doing all that. I had to do it this year. I think they found someone else, but I wasn't charging them. I'm just like, give me the media. Let's make sure it's done right. I have multiple computers at my place. So it's like I can be in my office working, and then in my little workshop, I've got another really nice computer that I actually did a trade for with Bob. I'll make your swimmer disc if you give me that computer that
one
you don't
want. One
of my
favorite
movies. Yeah. Wow. But, you know, so I would do it like that. But I can do this
Wait,
stuff.
Did we get to Bob? I'm sorry.
Obviously, you've done restoration and a lot of stuff, too.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that.
But what about when's the first time you traveled for work? Because, again, Becca mentioned earlier that you went with Bob initially to like Rome and Italy and stuff.
He didn't go. That was basically we were doing Zombie with Blue Underground. I went.
Okay.
It was Zombie – House by the Cemetery for Blue Underground, and then Bob was doing the Beyond. So him and Lustig, they kind of, between Grindhouse and Blue Underground, they split the cost and then to send me over there. So I brought all my gear and we went, and then I just kind of did. I had Paolo Zaletti, great guy over there. He translated because everyone's speaking Italian, but that's where I met Fabio Frizzi, which I've then worked with him on Frizzi to Fulci and all of that. But that was the first time, I think. I'm trying to remember. Maybe your listeners know when Zombie came out. I don't remember now. Probably be 4 or 5 years.
Well, that's amazing
to
end up in Italy shooting for these movies that you know.
In particular, House by the Cemetery. And there was Gino De Rossi, please tell me I didn't get his name wrong, who did the effects on those. Mm-hmm. He gave Paolo the very poker prop that stabbed the real estate agent that I was dying over when I was a kid. And I think there's another one. They do something to the babysitter against the door in the basement. I forget what it is, but it's fucking brutal. And I remember just being like, it's real. Like, as a kid, I'm watching a snuff film in those the Highland Park 3.
Wow. Well, the thing about Murawski that we learned when he was on the show, because, you know, he's an Oscar-winning editor at this point.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not restoring, you know, Gone with the Pope or The Beyond for the money.
Oh, God, no.
He's very much of the same mindset.
Yeah.
So, you know, talk a little bit about meeting him. I mean, is he kind of a kindred spirit in that regard? Because you both have that similar sensibility where you're just doing it because we have to do this.
I began to tell that, and of course I tangented him off, but I would go and shoot at the New Beverly and the Cine Family and this and that. And there was a night where I was, I think Jeff Lieberman was in town, and I would help this guy, Jason Rutherford, was shooting a Masters of the Grind doc about.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I still haven't seen that one, but because I started Elijah's first.
There was a problem with the editor. Something happened, but I met Jason there, and I would shoot for him for free. I would just be like, he'd be like, hey, man, are you going to do the Q&A? Can we grab Lieberman by the dumpster in the back? Like, sure, whatever, you know. But we would just shoot that. But Bob saw my camera. It was actually Eric Caden, rest in peace. Yeah. He, I was interviewing him that night, and Bob saw my camera set up. It was a Panasonic HVX200, which for everyone who cares, I'm sure. And Bob saw it and was like, wow, this is really nice. What are you doing? You know. And then I introduced myself, and then he realized, like, oh, you work with Bill, and obviously they're all friends. And then he was like, well, shoot for me then, you know. It just went like that. It naturally grows. They see, if you're there and you have your camera and you look like you know what you're doing,
Was Sage still part of the company then?
Yes.
So Sage was still around. So yeah.
When Sage passed, that's pretty much when I came in.
Right.
And that's when the Blu-ray started. We started with An American Hippie in Israel, but the timing, I'm not going to say I shuffled in but it was that time when the Blu-ray started. So that was really when my relationship with Grindhouse releasing began. And we did American Hippie in Israel. I've done all his releases since.
Which is a crazy film. Yes. Like, that's another that's one that movie, isn't very well known, but it's very bizarre.
It's a better trailer than movie. In my opinion, Bob hates when I say that, but it's such a great trailer. It's a little bit of a slog to get through, like the Cats movie.
Who have you interviewed the most at this point? Do you even know? Like, that's the thing is, like, most people, there's specific actresses. I know Sybil Danning is one that would prefer you to shoot them because they've shot with you so much that they know you'll make them look good. So who have you shot with the most, do you think?
Probably, I'd say Steve Johnson has been at least 8 times through all those. Now you got me on the spot. I can't even think right now. Definitely Steve Johnson's the one that like flies to the top of my head. But there's like Stacey Keach has been in 5 times in the last 3 months.
Oh, man, that's great.
Right?
I love Stacey Keach.
You know, he's fantastic.
But well, Rob, you told a story once. I don't know if you can tell it or not, but when you were meant to interview Carpenter and how he kind of stepped in and Carpenter was being kind of – I mean, you don't have to tell him, but being kind of cranky.
You know what?
And,
because Jim's here, I'm going to tell the story because it's one of my favorite Jim stories. So basically what happened was at this point I had never met John Carpenter. He's my hero. So I get called – that Jim and I are going to interview him for They Live, right? Yeah, it was They Live.
Yep.
And
right after his eye thing.
And here's the thing, Scream Factory had not happened yet. This was the first 3 titles, Halloween 2, 3, and They Live. And it was at Jim's old studio, and Carpenter had very specific rules. He wanted a certain kind of coffee and fucking grapes or whatever the hell was like set up for him. He had just had eye surgery, which I didn't know. And also, he refused to talk about anything other than They Live. They just said, like, don't ask him about Halloween 2 or 3. You're going to piss him off, blah, 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 blah. And me and Jim get there. We're like getting ready, and I decide I'm gonna win over John. I'm gonna name drop Sean Keller and Jim Agnew because they've written a bunch of scripts for him, or whatever.
Yeah.
So John comes in and he says hi, whatever. And I'm like, hi, you know, I know Sean and Jim and this and that. It's a pleasure to meet you. He's like, oh yeah, those are good guys. So is this coffee ready? And I'm like, oh okay, let me get your coffee, whatever. And then he sits down. And he's like, by the way, I just had eye surgery, so I can't freaking see you. So you're just going to have to do the best you can. And I'm like, all right. And the thing is this, I rely heavily on eye contact because I try to make the editor's life easy. And I am cut out of it. You know, the questions are cut out. Right. You're editing a clean soundbite of the other person. So I try very carefully I like a lot of eye contact so the person knows that I'm engaged and then in between whatever. So I ask him like 2 questions and then Jim chimes in. He's like, oh, do you think maybe you can elaborate a little bit about that last thing? And Carpenter's like, oh, finally, somebody with a little enthusiasm asking something. And I was just like, oh, man. I was like, well, and the only way I could rebut that, I was like, you know, you're a little intimidating, man. And he's like, oh, you cut that shit out right now. And I was like, don't say that. Let's get to business or whatever.
That's a good story, though.
And then, but the 2 best things to that. So then we reached the end of the interview, And Jim, bless him, is like, fuck it, I'm going for it. He's like, so you know, we're working on Halloween 2 and 3, and I have a clip still where he's like, I didn't make this fucking movie. I'm not talking about this fucking movie. Turn that fucking camera off. And so we cut, and then like 2 seconds later, he's fine. But the thing I love about Jim is he had a Halloween 2 foreign poster with some woman that's not in the movie at the bottom, and he's like, I'm going to ask John about it. So we're done. We wrap. After the little debacle with Halloween 2 or 3, he's fine. And then Jim comes running up to him all excited. He's like, hey, listen, man, I got this Halloween 2 foreign poster. I got to know who this girl is in. And he's like, you want me to look at a poster when I've just had eye surgery and can't see? And basically, Jim's like shoving him to the poster. He's like, oh, come on, don't be an asshole. Come on, look at it. Here. This is totally who it is. And so they like run up to the poster, and John's like up like a few inches away from him. He's like, yep, don't know who that is. And that was it. And then you've shot with him like 10 more times. And now obviously we know Sandy and love Sandy.
She's a wonderful person.
And I, you know, he's obviously warmed up a little bit since then. Yeah. But
I like that.
Funny.
I like that. The thing that sums up about you, and I try to live like this pretty much too, is like, you know, when in Rome, like if you have somebody right in front, if you have an opportunity, fucking seize the day.
There's no fear about it.
Because, and there's sometimes I do have fear like that, but the older I get, the less I do, because you just, some people drop dead sometimes. Some of the things, people you never meet them again. You know, it's a crazy world.
I just remember, and this is my Jim Coon safety story.
We're telling stories that you in the room.
Just in case he doesn't make it, we want to eulogize him right now.
We were doing the bonus features for, it was the Kino Loiber, Your Vice is a Locked Door and Only I Have a Key.
Hey, no.
And so we were at Eli Roth's house. And right before, we had to be there at like 11 a.m. And I have these crazy food allergies. Like when most people say like, I'm allergic to milk. I might get a little hivey or I can't eat wheat because my face might swell a little bit. Mine kill me. And so, no, I mean, literally, like I will go, they call it anaphylactic shock. Like I go into full like cardiac arrest.
Elric and I have gotten instructions on how to use the needle.
Yes.
We still don't know.
It's
we think we're supposed to stab her in the heart.
In the eye.
Not the heart, kids. Not
really,
the heart.
It's the leg.
I saw Pulp Fiction. I got this.
Yeah. No, not the heart, guys. Yeah. That'll kill you. That's only for drug ODs. But anyway, so I have these like really, really intense food allergies. And I had a reaction the morning we were supposed to do our interview with Eli Roth. And this is at like 8 a.m. I had a reaction to what I ate for breakfast. I had to take a ridiculous amount. It's not even Benadryl. What they give you if you have like a super reaction is like Benadryl times 10. And then you also get all these steroids on top of it. And it's like a whole like cocktail of medications. And I'm like, I can't cancel it, Eli Roth. And so I show up for this interview and I was so, I can only describe myself as drunk. Like I should not have driven there. And I literally handed the questions to Jim and said, can you read these to him? And I had a feeling I was slurring. And Jim took the entire thing. And all I did was stand in the background and smile the entire time. And Jim set everything up. He did everything. And then at the end, I said, thank you. And then I walked back to the car. And it was a total like Jim Coon star.
He's a goddamn saint.
Yes.
Saving us.
Oh my gosh.
Saving us
on
all these things.
It was amazing.
But you know what? All right. So here's where we're going to go.
Tell us about hard drives again. I know you will.
You should see the pile of G drives I have.
You just buttoned that.
But here's where we have to go from there. So there's a little documentary that Severin did called Lost Soul, The Doom Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau.
Yes.
Get the title up. But you shot and produced this.
Yeah,
correct?
With David Gregory.
And here's the thing. Richard Stanley's in this doc a lot. Richard Stanley stayed with Jim when he was in town.
Which is crazy. I heard stories about this. And Richard Stanley, like to preface it, has lived on a mountain in France.
He's a weird roommate.
Yeah, for like decades prior to this. He's not exactly a social dude, and you let him stay with you.
And not just that, but it was when the movie was done, and he was in town, they were doing the premieres and all that stuff. You guys had him on the show, didn't you, or no?
Yeah, yeah. We did,
right? That's what I thought.
Yeah. And we were doing the Betamax screening we did that you're involved in, too.
We're finishing that right now,
actually. He was involved in.
He came to trivia, too.
I love that. Yeah. That's right, because you're staying at my house at the time. Yeah, but when he came to the house, he had been on the mountain in France, like nothing, no heater, nothing, barely, I don't think there's warm water, 6 months. Trug through the snow to come down the mountain, gets into whatever car, driven to the airport, gets on the plane wearing his Dust Devil jacket, and then he gets off the plane and goes straight to my house. So it was like feral Richard at that point. And then it got, but it was great. I mean, it was, and God bless Melissa, my girl, she's like, sure, he can stay here, whatever.
Yeah.
And then you don't realize, like, Richard commands every room he's in. There's no personalities. He's the most interesting guy, far more than the Dos Equis guy you were talking about.
Oh my God, yeah.
But just the stories are insane. Yeah. I mean, I don't even want to talk about most of what was going on, but he definitely is just interesting. And every time, you know, nobody gets more excited about a full moon than werewolves and Richard Stanley.
Yeah.
For real. I mean, but he's fascinating. No, doesn't matter what he's talking about.
I remember just casual conversation he told me about a voodoo priestess that he chats with. And yeah, it's like.
Well, one was in the documentary.
Yep.
That was a not voodoo.
No, that wasn't voodoo.
That was a
psychic.
A warlock.
And we're doing his next, not job, but we're doing his other documentary now as well.
Oh, what's his new documentary?
Can't talk about it. Oh. No, it's about his days in Afghanistan and all this. It's totally crazy.
Oh my gosh. Totally crazy. No, Richard Stanley by far was one of my favorite Killer POV episodes just because it was so fascinating. Like I wanted to keep asking, like usually our conversations wind down by the end and we're like, that was great talking to you. We're all going to go home now. I wanted to say, can we go get coffee? I need to ask more questions about the warlock.
Well, because he kind of seems like a shaman.
Yeah.
But he is.
Yeah.
And he gives tours, like tours will come and he'll like hobble up the mountain with a cane. I was like, and for sure he's acting. Like he walks fine, but you see pictures of him on Facebook like, oh. But no, he's a great, one of the most fascinating people I've ever met in my life. And it's is it crazy having him at your house? Yeah. Would I do it again? Absolutely.
I remember that I was shooting. You let me shoot in your dungeon.
Oh, yes.
Everyone's like, oh, he's a sex freak. This is, can you explain the dungeon? I mean,
okay. So Jim lives in this house up in the Sherman Oaks Hills and built – it's like the Sherman Oaks Hills. I mean, they're mountains. And built into the side of the mountain is this like carved out stone – cellar, but
like
it's
the
like
reason I rented the house is what
it looks like a cellar, but it's not a cellar because it's carved into the side of the mountain, and we call it the dungeon because it's stone walls because it's carved into the mountain, so it literally does look like a dungeon. And so like a lot of people have shot dungeon scenes there because it's perfectly stone walls and it's stone floor and it's carved. It looks like it's carved by hand.
Yeah, there was a stone mason that owned the house up until the 90s when he passed away. I tried to get the history of like, why is this here? Because the property is so bizarre. And it goes back for acres behind it. It's
like,
crazy.
The door is like, it looks like it's handmade wood with iron works on it. Like it looks crazy old. So Jim let me shoot something in his dungeon, and I remember showing up there and there was literally this bucket mound of cigarette butts. Like it was mounding over, and I was like, and it was sitting in your yard, and I was like, Jim, I didn't know you smoke. And you go, oh, Richard left yesterday. And I was like,
all Richard's
oh,
nice.
So. Oh, man. All right, Elric, I'm going to set you up here because I know there's a company that you're in love with, and this is the man to ask questions to. But you know that Jim has worked on a lot of Code Red stuff.
Oh, shit, we need scoops.
Well, I mean, there's only really one question. Are they real people who run that company?
Are we going there now?
Code Red Bill real?
They have argued with me on Twitter before, and I'm just like, and I haven't even said, like,
we don't know if they exist.
Like,
but I also don't want you to get in. I don't want to.
I'm not
going to
get in trouble. So we're not even talking Banana Man. We're talking specifically Code Red Bill and Walt, or just Bill.
Well, I mean, I don't think Bill's real. Obviously,
Bill's real.
No, I mean, it's clearly just one guy who's doing
it's
culture.
Everyone. I was first. Let's talk the Olsons.
Yeah, the Olsons. So and how they exist, how that started.
Yeah.
As far as
these guys are old school because Bill Lustig is the one who told me he used to buy Japanese import laser discs from these guys out of their house in Seattle back in like the 90s.
Wow.
And so these guys are really, they've been doing this for a long time.
Wow.
They used to own or run video stores because people, they're very socially awkward. I think they're nice. I'm pretty much the only person.
Have you met them physically?
All the time. I do. We drove up to get Juliet Mills in Ojai. So I was in the car with them for an hour and a half each way just a few weeks ago.
Interesting.
And then people like Damon Packer would be like, how do you do it? Because he does stuff for them too.
I remember he edits some of their stuff.
Yeah, but I don't know. I love... like having, there's someone that would have Richard Stanley at their house and be like, I can't fucking do this. After a night, I love interesting people and people that are different. So to me, I was introduced to them as the Olsen twins. And I was like, the girls.
Oh, that's crazy cool. That's
but funny. Yeah, right. But they're not actual twins. They're brothers. But Walt runs Scorpion Releasing and Bill runs Code Red DVD, which is Blu-ray. So I just naturally, fragmented off to them and I started doing stuff for them as well. And they're real. They're interesting people. They'll have someone in, like Ray Wise comes in a lot. He's friends with them somehow. They know him, but he's been in for a few things to the point where they're genuinely friendly. And they don't have IMDb. Like they have little flip phones. They're not technically, technical savvy people, but they just know everything that you've done. up until the 90s, then they don't know fuck all about anything.
Right.
But any of your thing from the 70s, 80s, into early 90s, they know every TV movie of the week. They know what order. They know what year. They know who's in it. They know what – I mean, it's crazy.
Well, and that would account for why it's such an – the reason I love that label is because it's the only label – where I haven't seen some of the stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I'll look at it and go, I have never heard of this fucking movie, and then I need to buy it.
Yeah,
and that's what I love about it.
When so Soul collected. Survivor came out, I remember Elric saw it, and then I saw it, and both of us were just like, this is crazy that
things
we've
you just
never
haven't heard
seen
of.
This.
And also, they, you know, they jump around all the genres, and you know. But I mean, how do they, I mean, how do you find these titles? How, I mean, to actually procure the rights to these things.
For them?
And also, why do some of them just disappear? Like, why is Soul Survivor out? Why is, you know, is there a reason that these things are, if you're allowed to say.
I'm allowed. You would. But you should have them on the show.
Oh no,
we would love, to.
I've been dreaming that my whole life.
Yeah, we've tried. I've this is goes back to like the weird social presence. I have messaged them so many times on Facebook and Twitter, easily a dozen. I have never received a single response.
Send a photo of yourself next time with that email.
That's all it takes.
Next week's guest. I know they're both going to hear this. So, yeah. I mean, it's definitely, they're interesting. And it's not just that, you know, they probably won't let you take a picture of them or anything.
Yeah,
but otherwise, to sit and talk, it would be hilarious and entertaining because it's Bill. It's just, he just get, I mean, I've got notes. I made notes of like all of the labels I work with.
Were you on their
the
Butcher
movies.
Baker release? Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker?
No.
Okay, yeah. That
was but good. I want, I know, I wish
it's
I was.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
But again, it's hard. I've shot so many of these things. Sometimes I forget. I don't even know what I worked on.
Yeah.
And when they come in, it's like, you'll talk about whatever movie, but then they'll also talk about your entire filmography, like when we're done. It's like, oh, let me ask you a couple questions about some other movies we love. And then just, there's another hour in front of the camera. And usually the people just eventually are like, what are we doing, guys? I gotta go. You know, it's they'll get as much as they can. There's no kind of social barrier there. They just like, the person's there, they wanna hear it all. But as far as why movies disappear, why they don't, he talks about it. It's like they don't even have distribution at this point. It's all sold through a big cartel or whatever that is.
Diabolique picks them up sometimes.
Diabolique. Yeah, I love that company.
Yeah,
I'm glad that they sell them through them.
Yeah, Jesse's amazing.
I've tried to get them up with CAV and some of the other back ends that these people have used, and they just won't do it. He's like, I don't want to do it. I'd rather deal with them. I'm like, you don't have to ship anything. You'll sell more. You'll be on Amazon. I don't care. They just don't want to do it. Or I say they. It's really more Bill. I talk with him more about that. But again, they would probably both come in and talk and be extremely interesting. You should put it. I mean, they're listening. I guarantee you, they're listening to this. So,
alrighty. Well, I mean, I already gave enough love to Night of a Thousand Cats, which is one of the releases that no one can get. So,
what you want to talk about with them? Because I called both of them today. I talked to Bill. I didn't talk to Walt, but I said, "Hey, what is it that I can talk about, and what can I?" Because I'm going to go on. I don't know. I had no idea what you guys were going to ask me, so I was just kind of trying to cover my bases. And the one that was most interesting is The Farmer. You know that?
No.
It's never been released.
When's it coming?
It's not.
Oh.
And it's one that's never – it's one of those lore movies. And I love getting movies and uncensoring them, like Deep Red. I love getting the video nasties. I've got my name on almost all of them at this point. I'm just finding – somehow working on and getting them out because I hate censorship. I always love deleted scenes and all that growing up. So – The Farmer's one. I talked to him about it today, and he's like, it's not worth it. It'll only sell 500 copies, but there's a music licensing issue, and that's the ultimate problem. But to them, it's not worth the trouble anyway because it's not going to sell. But if you had distribution, it would sell. So again, I don't want to talk about their business on the air, but there's certain ones they have that would – they're lost movies that could come out. And
I'm intrigued by The Farmer. Like, I want to go back
and
do a
research
project on
this. Couldn't you go in if it was a music
this.
License problem and try to take out that piece of music, like, using your
– But then you're changing the film, original. And it's a different copyright.
See, I'm a purist with this stuff. I like to – I'm not one of these dicks on, like, a Blu-ray site that's like, there's a frame missing. I need my money back. If the movie's unedited and you've done you've done your work and tried to get it as good as you can, I'm happy. And that's what I want. I love everyone says Blu-ray is the last physical media format, and it may be the best we ever get as far, you know, who knows what's next, hologram, whatever, but this may be it.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's like, I don't mind dedicating my time. I can never figure out how to fund features, so like, I'll do documentaries. I'll work on these movies I love because they need to exist.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, you know, because we got into this conversation once before. You know, what's your, as somebody that works on special features, how do you enjoy special features? The reason I bring this up is because I am of the old school mentality there. I like a little documentary. I like an hour long thing with everybody going back. But I remember you said you went on one of the boards just to kind of do it. And it seems that primarily most people prefer single one-off interviews.
I put a post on Reddit under the DVD. It was like a DVD collectors or whatever it is. And I just said, hey, What do you guys prefer? Do you prefer a big documentary? And most people say that I don't need to hear some DP drone on and on when all I care about is the effects. And another person's like, well, I'm more interested in the actors. I don't care about you guys always focus on the special effects. And it's just, you can never please everyone.
Oh, see, I'm more prone to watch the documentary. Cause yep. I'm yeah, like, oh, that'll cover everything.
Cause it tells a story.
Yeah, absolutely. It tells a story and it's been edited together. It's not just a straight
like
interview.
David Gregory's amazing Joe Spinell story. One of my all time. Yep.
I think that's one of his favorites as well. It's fantastic.
Yeah,
that's
so good.
Now, you mentioned, skipping around a bit, you mentioned how you tend to work with interesting personalities and that you work well with interesting personalities. I want you to talk about the fact that you were Crispin Glover's DP.
Oh, yes.
All because right. you good told story, me remember. Stories, and even I was like, that is amazing.
Jim made a movie with Crispin Glover. Let's yes.
Eccentric right. personality.
At first off, I was not the DP. There was already... Oh, no, it's all fine. I was like AC or something. But as I went, my duties grew, and I was like, only Jim can handle the firearms. I'm like, Crispin, you have no idea what you're doing. But it was like, I just more and more. He trusted me. He knew I help him. And I'm seeing him Tuesday. I'm helping him edit the movie still 2 years later. But yeah.
Oh my God. You guys finished it? Because I remember when you were there, you were telling me like, yeah, the 7-second shot would take like a day because Crispin was so deliberate and meticulous with everything.
Yes. He had made a couple movies before that. I've seen two of his earlier movies that are very interesting.
What is it?
What is it? And
oh shit, I can't believe I can't
remember. It is what?
They're both questions.
It is fine. Everything is fine.
Everything is fine.
So, let me burn through this one real quick. I was doing Popcorn, the Synapse release that finally came out a few years ago, and I met Bruce Glover and interviewed him, and then he had a little acting class. And as I do, as I've said before, I was like, you know what, Bruce, I'll come. Let me come. He was like, oh, I'll come to the acting class. I'm like, I'm not an actor, man. Sorry, but I'll come film it. You want your? He's like, oh, that'd be great. So I came and filmed his acting class one night and just set it up. So you know, it's, whatever. He loved it. I worked great with him. He said, you got to meet my son, Crispin. He's going to love you. You guys will work. He's working on a movie. You got to do it. I'm like, sure, Bruce, whatever. That's cool. Sure enough, Easter night, 2014 or 2015. I don't even remember. A couple of years ago, it's like 11 o'clock on Easter night and the phone rings and it's Crispin. I'm like, of course, nobody's doing anything. It's Sunday, you know, Easter night at 11. But he just said, hey, my father said, I don't want to do his voice because it's so insulting, but he's like, my father says you're great. You want to join the production? I said, sure. He's like, you got to fly yourself out here. Like, there's no money. There's nothing. But
fly to where?
Prague. So he's got his castle.
He owns the castle.
He's got his castle. Just it's outside of Prague in the Czech Republic. It's like a 40-minute drive. A place called Kolín or something like right out there. Not Kolín. But I lived there for a month. And it was a dream for me because, A, we were shooting on 35mm on an Arri BL2, which is amazing. And I always heard stories doing the old Charlie Band, you know, dolls and all these movies of like, oh, we'd all go to Romania and live in the castle. And it was like a reality show and everyone's sleeping with each other's drama. I'm like, this sounds so cool. I missed that. That would have been amazing. And then sure enough, that opportunity comes. I went and I lived in the castle for a month.
Was it like crazy with everyone drinking and sleeping with each other?
Absolutely not.
Oh.
Because he is a raw vegan. So I know you guys, I'm like meat and potatoes. I barely eat anything green. I fucking lost 10 pounds. I starved myself
Wait,
to death.
Did he make the whole crew, like, was the catering raw vegan?
He did the catering. There was a kitchen. He had stables. There's stables behind his chateau, castle, whatever you call it, that he basically spent years building these sets in to make this movie. And I thought we were doing the third of that series of his, but it's a total different movie. I don't even want to say the name. He's very private with all this stuff. But we shot it, and we lived there, and I basically starved. I ate beans. He said, I don't mind if you guys eat stuff. I'm not going to provide any kind of food that I feel is unhealthy for anyone. But it's just like, I'm not trying to eat kale and fucking raw, like almonds. You know, I would pick at things, but it was rough. There's a little market behind there that I would go, but it was an absolutely fascinating time. He's great. We became friends as far as like I help him with editing the film. He edits his films himself, so I'll give him sound effects or come. He's like, Jim, all the audio's gone. I was driving from Las Vegas to Utah, and I'm like, what, you're editing in the car? Like, why? Let's just skip that aspect, and let's just really focus on like, what did you do?
So one of our listeners is going to drive past Crispin Glover while editing in the car.
I thought I misheard him, but he's definitely driving, and I'm pretty sure the laptop is, again, may not be true. I don't know.
Were there actors in this film, or is it more of a like local people kind of?
Absolutely actors. A lot of it was mostly women, which was interesting because there was a lot of maybe friends of his or something. I don't know, but a lot of the actresses were there. But it was a great crew. The DP is this guy, Kai. I'll mess up his last name, Mendenkorb or something, but he's a really nice guy, German guy. A lot of the crew is from Berlin because it was pretty close by. They just drove over, but absolutely fascinating time. Like, it cost me money. I didn't work for a month. It's like my rent doesn't pay itself. It was so worth it. To me, people are like, how can you do that? How can you afford to do that? I'm like, I look at it like this. If that was the grand prize in some contest that you could win that trip, that would be an awesome.
You just won something.
What I felt like. I said, this is an opportunity not to just to go do like the Charlie Band style, like live in the castle with everyone. But it was a very interesting just experience. Like you said, he loves Stanley Kubrick. Mm-hmm. Not Barton Fink. Barry Lyndon. Yeah, thank you. He loves that. And he's very particular. And we would sometimes sit around for hours while someone's collar that's in the background got fixed. But I can't wait for people to see it.
But you know it's going to come out. It's going to.
It will. No, I have made sure to stay on him. And I know it's been hard because he did American Gods and he's still a working actor, as he says. But we needed miniatures. There's a lot of stuff in miniature. I got him the guys I was friends with who built all the stuff from Anomalisa.
So
I got him to do the miniatures for him. And he just moved out of town yesterday. So Crispin just got the model. So I'm going to finally get to go see him on Tuesday. I haven't seen any of this stuff yet. But
cool.
I just do everything I can to try to get it to where like it's going to get done. Because he's like, I'll take 10 years. I don't know. You know, he just kind of does what he does. He doesn't know if he's American Gods. Will there be a season 2? That'll change everything. He doesn't really know what's happening. So fascinating guy.
I'd forgotten he's in that. That makes me so much more excited.
Oh, man.
Because he's such an interesting actor. He's like, because I love anyone who's unpredictable. That's why Klaus Kinski was so good, because you didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah.
You have no idea what's going to happen. And Crispin always had that. Even in Back to the Future, a film that feels otherwise safe, he's still being unpredictable within the safe world, which is pretty cool.
The Beowulf movie, amazing. Like, I remember seeing that in 3D and being like, ah. But every single time he was on screen, it was great.
I said, it's the only one I haven't seen.
It's surprising. I saw it in 3D IMAX, so I spent the whole time going, whoa. There are moments of it that are bad.
If your movie looks like a video game cutscene, I'm probably not going to watch it. And that whole movie looked like a big cutscene to me.
Yeah.
That's about right.
But
American Gods, have you seen the gore? Have you seen?
I haven't seen much. I'm trying to stay away.
God like hits you with something, like it is so fucking cool.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Trailer, I haven't seen it, but if the trailer shows,
I saw the first episode.
Your shoulder. Oh, did you?
I loved it. Yeah, I loved it.
Did you go to the premiere?
No. I just, you know, Brian was on our show and he asked if I wanted to see it. And I was like,
it's amazing.
Yeah, it's great.
Anyway, so I don't know if the gore looks incredible in that.
I wanted to ask you about, because and it's changed a lot since, but at the Underground Fest, we showed kind of the premiere, advanced premiere in a sense, because you guys were editing it that day.
They were shooting a segment the day that the movie premiered. But that's what you wanted. You wanted like punk rock.
And I got to admit, like I held my cool pretty well. I kept telling you, I believe, and only reason I think I did was because I had your guarantee. No one else I would feel that confident would like come through.
What's
and I was like, even if
this?
He doesn't sing, it was called Betamax at the time, still is.
I think the name is changing. It started off as kind of a joke about VHS and all of those that were happening. So
you did Betamax as an anthology.
David Gregory approached me and he said, look, we kind of want to make a goof. Everybody gets $100. It's going to be you, Damon Packard, Scooter McRae, Mikey Toll, I think. But everyone's going to do segments. So of course I'm like, I better spend $7,000 and shoot on the red and do it. And it's a weird movie. And I said, I don't have a story. I said, David, write something for me. He said, okay. And we were doing the Society special features at the time. So I said, let's focus on technology and body horror. That's what I love. So
your film looks like the inside of your brain. So if you're listening to this right now and all the technology he's talking about, that's what's in his short. Like it's everywhere. There's tech everywhere. It's literally like a guy's head exploding. It's almost like Tetsu or something. You're like cyber mind explosion.
Wow.
But the cool thing about the film at the time was there were all these different shorts. But even since then, some of the shorts have gone out. Some new ones are coming in. Yep. I've got to say the crazy John Carpenter thing that Damon made. This is the one that John Carpenter's dead movie.
John Carpenter's a corpse.
John Carpenter's a corpse.
It's truly like Damon Packard. The moment of seeing it, it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. Like it's so outrageous, and some of the leaps he makes, and I mean purposeful jokes, not like so bad it's good. He's actually making jokes about Tom Savini, and like there's just things in it that as a horror fan, you kind of shit yourself laughing because Damon's kind of humor is just one of a kind oddball, but it's really great. So I've been waiting just for people to see that. But we had, we had a 2-hour film festival of crazy shorts, followed by this even crazier movie, which, and Scooter McRae was one that left because he.
Yeah, well, he did St. Frankenstein. And it's so good.
Yeah, it's so well done. Short,
yeah, and I basically thought like it's not fair to St. Frankenstein that it's in Betamax, and it's not fair to Betamax that St. Frankenstein.
It's also not really about technology in the same way that the others are.
But some of the other ones are just random stuff. It's just I didn't feel like it's such a classy. It's so serious, and it's such a good short that he eventually.
wanted to be on the festival circuit.
Yeah,
that's totally understandable.
As he should have. Yeah. And he's a great guy. Scooter's fantastic. Yeah. And it's so incredible that what he did
the
on
casting,
that movie.
It's one of the most amazing
I sound like
casting.
I'm licking ass right now, but it really is good.
So what came in instead? What's going to be
I don't want to say, but it's there's another one. And then we took the wraparound. We did more with Richard. So Dennis, you know, comes back.
Okay, so yeah, so if you're not paying attention, Richard Stanley's part of this too. He also, he plays a character in it.
Yeah.
Did he shoot it here? Yeah, like he came to LA to shoot it again.
Oh, he just was in town.
Well, it was when he was in town. So there was one point where we were going to work on Dust Devil. So we were going to go to the desert and shoot him in the Dust Devil jacket and all that. But unfortunately, I forget what company, it didn't work out. But we did get him in front of the camera quite a bit while he was in town. And that was one of the things. That was Bobby Hacker is the one who did that one.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the wraparound segment, if you can call it.
But it was like perfect for this underground thing, because it was like we're putting on the first underground fest in Hollywood, and it's like we're showing a movie that we don't know if anyone's ever going to see it again, except for the people in this weird audience.
They were shooting it this morning.
And as it turns out, no one will ever see that version of that movie ever again. It'll be a totally different movie. So I love that
different
spirit.
Now.
You know?
Yeah. But no, I'm being, David's actually forced. We're finishing it up this month and next month. So it's coming out. So it's going to be, I don't even know what it's going to be called. I'm so used to Betamax that I'm just like, fucking leave it.
We'll let you know what Betamax becomes.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the movies, like while you're watching it, because film discovery for us is like a huge part of the show. Often, obviously for our listeners, us telling them about some new movie blows their mind, vice versa when they tell us about something. What are some of the movies that you've worked on, like that you've like hadn't seen when you got the gig, or, you know, you had to start researching thing that were kind of blew your mind on the way? Can you remember, or is it just a constant like river of craziness?
That's the problem, is there's a lot, like you said, a lot of the Code Red Scorpion stuff is mostly what I don't know.
Yeah.
But they're so interesting to me that I'm like, well, let's just do it. Why not? Like, go tell the Spartans. Like, I didn't know what that was. It's a decent movie. It's just I would have never, you know, a lot of it isn't horror for them. And I really try to stick with horror, especially at this point. I really try to focus on the movies I like. There's a specific thing that I kind of go out of my way for. And people know, like, if you're doing, like, I'll go to David and I'll say, like, what does Severin have coming out? Like, can I do, Kathy's Curse, are you serious? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. That's right, you were working on
that. Oh, that's what we didn't say. I author the discs as well for some of these companies. I'll design the menus and deal with all the video transcoding and all that stuff. Because it's like Phil Blankenship, he's like, he notices that when I do it. He's like, yours look better. Because I will literally do it, I'll transcode a movie 24 times. Huh. This scene, everything looks perfect except that one hallway scene. Boom. Section that one out, up the bitrate a little, redo it.
Wow.
Okay, that's better. Like, my goal is always, whatever uncompressed video master I get, I want the disc to look identical, if possible. Sometimes there's only 25 gigs on a single layer and there's extras, I can't do it. I'll push for a dual layer, whatever I can do to make it so it's exactly like what I received.
It's like you're the reason it's worth spending more money on a disc.
Yeah.
From what you're telling me, like what Arrow do or what Screen Factory do, it's like you're that effort, that extra step is what makes it worth buying something versus just watching it streaming, in my opinion. From what I hear, you know.
And again, when you're getting a Blu-ray, you're like 30, 35 megabits per second. When you're streaming even the nicest stream, you're lucky to be at 4 or 5. So you got to realize these discs are at 7, 8 times the bitrate.
That's a big difference.
That's why I prefer discs.
It's true. Yeah. No one needs to tell Rob this, man.
Nope.
This guy's
big proponent.
You're going to be dead in an earthquake. I don't know if you guys have seen this place.
Oh,
you're
going
to find a hand reaching out of a pile of discs of just
You know what?
He died doing what he loved.
Good way to go.
Yeah, exactly.
I got to say.
In 3D for real this time.
Now, 3D glasses. Do you have a collection? I mean, obviously you have all the ones that you work on, but I...
Nope.
I've never seen your collection
because
at your house.
When I did that, I made I said, look, I'm not going to be making a lot of money. I'm already straining my girl enough with what I work on and just not making that much money. Like, I'm not going to be able to make rent again this month. She's like, whatever, just keep doing what you're doing. But I basically said, I'm not going to buy any more movies. I'm not going to buy, we pay for our Netflix, our Hulu, all this kind of streaming stuff. And there's enough to watch. And then obviously I borrow sometimes from you, sometimes from whoever. I just can't. I can't. It's hard enough to collect the ones I worked on, so trying to get like everything I want, it's too much, and I can't afford it, to be honest.
But your setup is amazing. So like when you go to gym, like he has it's a drop down screen.
Yep.
Oh, at my house.
Screen,
you let me play video games on it. We played some zombie game on it, and I was
3D.
Like, this is amazing.
It is. It's a Panasonic 3D projector. Yeah, I don't know. We moved into that house, and there's nowhere in the living room to put a TV, so. We saved up for like a year and we had a little shitty TV sitting there. And then after I finally saved up enough money, I put that thing in, I had it installed in a nice projector, but it's great for watching movies.
Well, you said you're kind of ahead of the curve at times. So you're ahead of the curve when, shifting to computers from DJing, now doing the job you're doing and you're working on all these titles, Blu-ray, Obviously, people are always saying, oh, look, we're not selling in Walmart anymore. What do you, are you looking down the track? Or are you just so in love with what you're doing? Are you thinking, fuck, I got to start thinking about this side of the industry because this other part might just collapse at some point?
I still, my ultimate goal is still production. I still eventually want to be doing, you know, directing stuff like Betamax. Or again, I direct all of Elvira's shows. I met her in 2011 doing the revival. We haven't really talked about
Let's get to that. Crispin Glover, Code Red, Richard
Cassandra
Stanley.
Cassandra Peterson.
Elvira.
Jim does all of Elvira's stuff as of late.
And that had nothing to do with the name being her stealing my name for something. I don't know. I still don't know if she consciously could have done that or
Elric
how she.
Kane.
Well, Elric is the name of her.
Yeah.
Her son character.
That was the first episode I directed. On the 2011 show, The Son of Elvira, with Thomas Decker.
Decker plays Elric, and when I met her, I was like, I wonder if my name. So, because I don't know any. I mean, I'd never heard of another Elric.
It's the classic. Like, what's Elvira's son going to be named? Elric. Yeah, you know, it made sense. But no, that I did a lot with Grizz Grimley, the artist. He's over in Pasadena. Mm-hmm. He's a local, and I would DP. He had a guy that he always used, but he ended up going to shoot like the Vampire Diaries and all this stuff in Atlanta, so he wasn't around anymore. So Grizz was like, hey, man, you want to shoot this stuff? And he was directing the intro to her show, the movie Macabre. We did a cool thing at the Vista Theater, like a Steadicam shot, and I DP'd that. And I edited it and put, you know, I did all the graphics for it. And Cassandra and I got along pretty well, and it went very smooth. And so she contacted me a few weeks into the show, or a few episodes in. She's like, you know, we went with the lowest bidder. It's not really going well. Can you join the production? And I was like, absolutely. And then I just eventually started directing. And then I've just ever since, anytime she has any kind of video project, we did a whole 13-episode Hulu show, 13 Nights of Elvira, with all Charlie Band movies, which was fun. Well, plus Hobgoblins tonight. She always has to do Night of the Living Dead. No matter what, that's going to be on a movie macabre season, no matter what. But otherwise, it was cool because she'd never done uncut movies. So I got to do, since it was Hulu, I got to do uncut, you know, R-rated nudity and violence and all that stuff that usually would be cut out. But that was fun. Why are we talking about this again?
I don't know, but she's just a funny person.
Because you worked with Elvira.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's great. I saw her at Monsterpalooza and she's like, oh my God, Jim, there's a lot to talk about. And I'm like, let's do it. Like usually August is when we do Elvira. It's like, that's when the stuff comes for Halloween. You kind of shoot it, and then a few months later it comes out. So usually the end of summer is when I get busy with Elvira stuff, and then it kind of goes away.
Is that the most amazed you've been that you've been working with someone and just looking up and go, I'm working with Elvira? Because that's a larger-than-life kind of character.
The thing I like to say is that my parents don't understand anything that I do.
Yeah.
But they understand, like, oh, Elvira's on the TV. I don't know, that's not what they sound like, but they're like, you know, oh, that's Jimmy's show, Elvira's on. Like, they at least understand, like, what that does. Like, he makes that show, he directs that, and then it goes on the TV. They don't know what a special feature is. They don't know what film restoration is. They don't know any of the stuff I do. The technical work, forget it. I might as well be speaking, you know, Spanish or French, whatever.
And ironically, your dad's a big Code Red guy, right?
I wish. My dad actually is Code Red, Bill. That's the big secret.
Oh, no. I knew we would get it.
Twist. Yes, we got it.
That's the news.
That's the twist.
But I forget why we started talking about her.
Well, I just want to mention her. I mean, because also she does
awesome.
Basically, for the last couple of years around Halloween, she's at
Knox.
At Knott's Scary Farm doing a live show, and you help her and you direct the stuff that plays behind her as well.
Yep.
It's cool. I mean, that's the thing is part of the reason we wanted to have you on is because not only have you worked with everybody and helped everybody in restored movies, but we went from Code Red to Crispin Glover to Elvira to Richard Stan. I mean, you know, just the
and
names.
I remember like doing the shows. It was Killer POV back in the day, and me and Becca would talk about some. Like, I think we talked about 3 or 4 super obscure movies on one episode that you can't even get anymore. They're not available, so there's just no way to see them. And then I'm at Jump Cut the next day, and you just came up to me and handed me the discs of them on Blu-rays, and they don't exist anywhere. And you just said, "Here," and I said, "Oh, what?" And you're just like, yeah, no, I heard you mention these titles. I'm just like, holy shit. It's like, so you're also a weird film pimp, you know, which is pretty cool.
It's film pimp. Yeah. I can get pretty much anything from, you know, somewhere. There's a lot of collectors, a lot of people trade, internet, whatever it is. Not like sitting there torrenting, but there's private things. But we use them for these releases. I want everything I can find. If, you know, we're doing the Wild Geese, hey, I realize it on a French server, there's like a 10-minute raw footage from the set. Like, let's put it on the disc. It's just sitting on the internet.
Do you have any dream things left? Like, you talked about your Grindhouse exploitation. What are some of the titles that in your head that you wish?
I can name it right off the bat. Number one is The Dark Backward. Okay. Without question. Wow. I've talked with Adam Rifkin, who directed it. It's at Sony, and I have my relationship with them. I just... they don't do it. It came out, they did a special edition DVD, and Rifkin told me, he said, hey, I've got so much. If you can somehow get it to go You can do produce it. She'd do everything for it. So
is that the guy who, and pardon me if I'm wrong, but that's the one about the guy who literally divides in half, right?
No, an arm grows out. He's a stand-up comic and the arm grows out of his back.
Okay, but I remembered it as like How to Succeed in Advertising, but yes, like a really twisted version. Okay.
And again, one of my favorite Bill Paxton roles.
Yeah.
And
what about a foreign release? Because I mean, I don't know how rights work. Is Sony own it everywhere?
I don't know. I just know that they own it. For what I want to do, they own it. And
didn't Murawski get some of his titles from Sony at one point?
Yeah, I can't. I don't know the backstory of that, but yeah, he basically ended up getting Certain the Big Side. Gun Down, Corruption, yeah, and The Swimmer.
The Swimmer, which is one of the greatest releases.
That was probably one of the best discs I made for sure.
Yeah,
with
yeah,
them.
Yeah. And also just one of the best. Don't give up on it because it sounds like that really could be an amazing release. Maybe you'll be responsible for people reappraising that whole movie.
I hope so. Because again, it's one that I love it so much, but I'll show it to people that they like the five other movies. Again, that's the one. They're just like, something. I don't know. Maybe it's like. And there's some weird shit in that movie.
Yeah,
that's
just. Are there any others like that that are in your
that I want to put out?
Yeah.
Oh, you guys got me again. I don't.
That's okay.
I mean, there's so basically the remaining video now. I mean, I love the idea of uncut, of uncensored, of whatever the original vision of the filmmaker before the fucking lawyers and MPA, everyone gets involved and has their hands for no reason. I love that original. It's so hard to get anything done.
Now, have you done most of the video nasties? Like almost, did you do Island of, I can't even remember. It was one of the most extreme films I've ever seen.
I haven't. I know.
Okay. That one was like, it was one of the video nasties.
If it's not within my reach, I can't. If someone of the companies has it or something, then it's like, let's do it. I want to do it. I just, there's something about the whole backstory of that and just how fucking lame it was. Let's get these out. We should celebrate them in hindsight because that happened.
Now, I'm going to guess that you did help with the Video Nasty documentaries that David did.
I didn't know David yet. I would have, but I love it, obviously. Mm-hmm. And we've since put it on other things, but I wish. Wow. I absolutely wish. And he, obviously, David is from the over there, so he had more access to that and probably a much better knowledge than I ever will. But I just... There's just the general idea. I don't like when something gets cut to either appease a PG-13 or what, it's just like everyone says the same shit.
Well, censorship, just like terrorism, will never work because people like us get so much more fired up to support the things we love and to get behind it because it makes it punk to do it versus just, otherwise horror would just be a safe thing.
Yeah.
There has to be somebody in opposition to it to keep the fucking tension going, I think.
Today on the website, we actually posted up five films that had been banned in the US, and we're doing another five next week. And surprisingly, the majority of them aren't horror films. Huh. The ones that get banned in the US, the only one that was banned in the US that I was like, okay, well, that's straight horror, was Haxan. And that was, of course, banned when it originally came out, a long, long time ago. All the other ones are things like Titty Cut Follies, which was about...
That was also because of releases, people in the mental asylums,
Titty Cut Follies, even though it's a funny
Fred
name,
Wiseman
it's a documentary about the injustices that are being done against mental institution patients.
And a particular institution like New York in the 70s, and it's one of the most horrific films. It's like watching
horrific.
A horror film, but everything in it you're watching is real. It's like the dark, not fun version of Cuckoo's Nest. And you're like, it's kind of disturbing. The imagery is surreal. It's like Christmas and they're all doing this weird song. And you're like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, it's called Titty Cut Follies because they are doing a talent show that they have all of the patients do. And so that was kind of like the framework was the documentary crew was coming in to document this pageant that they have them do. But ended up just documenting all of
But it's opening up now. It's starting to play in a lot of theaters. And I think a disc is coming out.
Like
Wiseman's,
Flaming
big
Creatures
director.
Is on the list. Uh-huh. But very little of it was actually horror. It was all sexual content. I'm Curious Yellow, of course. And then all social injustices.
People are dumb.
Yeah.
Ultimately, people are stupid and get scared of themselves. Get scared that they get boners. People are scared of that shit for some
That's
reason. You know
American
what I mean?
It's very American, too.
It is. It's very American.
Elric, you never told your scariest story ever.
Rob will appreciate that.
Okay.
Only because this happened last night. You'll appreciate that. Last night, I went to the bathroom. I reached into my pants. And I pulled out my member. I'm trying to make this in. And I'm not kidding. Just before I can go to the bathroom, I hear from my pocket, Elric, did you butt dial me? Fucking Rebecca's voice in my pocket as I'm trying to pee. And it was the most terrifying fucking thing I've ever happened to me in my life. I literally couldn't. I was just like, oh my God, I'm hitting my pocket. And it was just like my nightmare coming true.
Literally, I see Elric's number and I knew he had just gotten back from New York. And I'm like, oh, Elric's calling. So I pick up the phone. And then I hear all of this fumbling, and then I'm like, it's like 40 seconds of like
really
nothing, just fumbling. And then I'm like, Elric, you butt dialed me.
I'm just glad I wasn't like going to have sex or something, because this would have been the worst night of my life. It's worse than your mom. It's Becca.
I'm really just coaching you through everything, including urination.
Anyway, so, I'm glad we shared that moment.
I was thinking of brain damage.
Yeah, exactly. Elmer.
I don't know how much you can talk about this, but as we wind down, something I've referenced several times in the show, because you work a lot of times with Steve Scarlatta, who's a good friend of both of ours, but the two of you are working on a documentary about novelizations, and that's something that it's come up on our show.
Again, Pure Cinema, we talked about.
And Brian Fuller, when he was on our show, said that that's how he got to most of the horror movies is he read the novelizations first.
So when you want to come check out all of my Slugs novels, just let me know. They're all on a shelf in chronological order.
And give me Teddy soon as you find it.
There's literally one copy of Teddy for sale on the internet for hundreds
of
dollars.
On eBay, it's about $250.
Yeah, I don't have it.
And here's the thing. Since starting this, you have a room in your studio that is a wall of novelizations. I will post a photo in our group.
Yeah.
It is ridiculous.
Actually just added a seventh shelf. It's actually bigger since we last took a photo.
Get out.
But no, yeah, I started compiling. If it's a screenplay that turned into a book, I want it. It started with just horror, and then now it's like fucking Crimes of the Heart is on there. That was always the one. It's like, I'm not going to put that. It's up there now. So, yeah.
Well, why that is a documentary? I mean, it's fast. As soon as you hear it, I'm like, I want to see that. But why that
Steven,
for you?
Steven brought it to me. I met them. I was in Fantastic Fest on the jury when Jodorowsky's Dune won, and I met them there. And then eventually he came around and was like, hey, my next thing, I'm really into movie novelizations, and do you want to, he just pitched it. First, it was like, it sounds kind of, is there a story there? But as he talked about it and he's so passionate about it, I'm like, well, this is actually pretty cool. So he's producing that, I'm directing that, and we're shooting all weekend at the Queen Mary. People are down for that, and we're shooting.
I'm going to be there at the Queen Mary.
I know
weekend.
That's right. There's
I'm on like five panels.
There's two female authors that are in town, so we're going down there. I had to get a fucking room for 3 nights just to shoot two interviews.
Oh, wow.
Because they're like, if you want a guarantee to be in there at 11 a.m., you need it for the night before. I was like, so there's a great suite if you want to sleep in it.
Oh
it's
my
not
gosh,
being
they're
used.
Not even getting me a room. I'm leaving my house at 5 a.m. on
brutal.
Friday morning to
but
get
these
there.
Books cost quite a bit now, yeah. So you could probably end up selling that collection and pay off this film.
Definitely. Well, that's what I told Steven. So I said, look, I have my little production company. Yeah. I have a cameras and lights and all this. I said, let's just do it. Yeah. Let's just go as far as we can, and you and I, it's our pie. We own it 50-50, and let's go as far as we can. If we got to slice someone in later, we will. But as of now, it's you and I, we're making this, and we sat and we went to lunches and we came up with how do we do it? What's the story? I had already interviewed Dennis Etchinson for a Videodrome release, and we got into, he wrote Halloween 2 and 3, The Fog and Videodrome. And so we kind of talked about the differences between working with Cronenberg and Carpenter, and it was actually just that was interesting enough to where I'm like, you know what? Steven's right. There is a story here. Yeah. It's an underdog story. It's a deleted scene story because of how different some of the books are. They're based on early screenplays, and then the film gets done later and they change it. So the novelization is actually the pure form of what it was. It's interesting, man. There's so many little rabbit holes to go down that it's becoming overwhelming at times, because like, what are we going to choose? Like, we can only really focus on so many things unless it'll be like me talking on this thing just all over the place. So it's cool though. It's definitely, it's going well. We've been shooting it. We've been, we just shoot for a little bit, and then I save up a little money, and then we go, we drive around. We got all the big guys, Alan Dean Foster. We've gotten pretty much everyone we wanted, and more are coming, and one introduces you to another, and you learn another story. And the fans, who collect these books are almost as interesting as the people, because nobody's had the same one that they love. I talk to these different people on the internet, wherever, and they all have this so passionate. It's just like movies, I guess.
Slugs.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. See? But it's like, it's cool. Like, that's interesting. So it's so special to so many different people that I'm hoping that it can at least run around and play and have some kind of life the way Lost Soul and some of these other ones did.
Is there one that, through the process of doing that you've become kind of just like you're kind of becoming obsessed with? A book, one of the books?
Yeah, I mean, and again, a lot of it is from Steven's research, because he does tons of research on this stuff. Yeah. And he brings it to me and I'm like, fuck, are you reading all these books? Yeah, like, how do you know this? But I don't know what he does. He goes away. Guy's a research monster. But I become obsessed with the ones I can't have.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I want the original Blood Feast paperback for the, as I build this library, it was originally like, oh, we just want to have it for B-roll and stuff, but it becomes this obsessive.
Yeah.
What you see, Rob, when you go to my office, when you look at those books, that's the soul of the documentary. That's like, it's grown and it's become this thing. It's so big and people just come in and look at it. They're like, fuck, this is cool.
Yeah.
And once they realize it's not VHS. Everyone thinks it's VHS. I think those are books. But that kind of keeps the spirit of it going. If we'll go a couple months and not shoot something while we're all focused elsewhere, that library is still growing. I'll always go on Amazon and throw at least, you know, all my family, what do you want for Christmas? What do you want for birthday? Amazon gift cards, eBay gift cards. Trust me. It will go fast.
Now, do you ever like go, because I find novelizations all the time at like the Goodwill in North Hollywood or that weird little thrift shop on Magnolia in Burbank always
has raided
some.
Them all.
I have, I'm like a local at the Iliad and all of them, but it's getting to the point now where there's got to be over 1,000 books in that thing, right? I mean, it's gotten to the point where if I stumble in something in the wild, it's like a miracle. Because I've gotten to the point where I need to go on Amazon. I don't even know what exists at this point. I've got a couple books and things that movie tie-in book written in the 70s I can use to research and find, oh, wow, they did one for this movie. I didn't even know that.
So just in case somebody could help, because I know I've been looking for Teddy, haven't had much luck except that one that's on eBay. What are a couple of the ones that you guys might really want? Because somebody might listen to this and have an old copy that they might be willing to lend to something like this, just in case.
Yeah,
this
like your wish list of novelization. Yeah, what is
you want me to read
just
that?
Just read if you have a few.
They're looking at my phone. It.
Well, if there's anything that's
plus, these are going to be like weird films. So yeah,
well, no, but
I
actually,
hear
you know what's funny is some of these. Now that I'm looking at the list, a lot of them are not. They're not really. I'm saying performance, Southern Comfort, like Hunt for Red October. I just don't have it. That doesn't mean it's hard to find.
Right. Right.
Phone Call, which was Bell's, I believe. Communion, which was Alice Sweet Alice, really expensive. Oh, yeah. Another one.
I have a Space Camp pennant in the kitchen. Not the novelization, but they made these like flag pennants when the movie came out.
Not
I have
helpful,
one.
Becca.
Not helpful.
It's great.
Not in any way, but I have
form
a pennant.
Into a book. Phobia, See No Evil, Sugarland Express. I mean, it's so many. Great Waldo Pepper. Got to get that one. Yeah. You know, if I know.
Wait, you're going off horror now.
Well, I know. I'm trying of the horror, but I've gotten most. I finally got Friday the 13th Part 3.
I got it.
My birthday was in March, and I had.
How much did that cost? Because I saw it at Monsterpalooza.
I paid $70.
Oh yeah, no, it was more at Monster. It was 85 a month, and I thought about you guys. I was like,
See, that's one that I go to the paperback show every year. I've tried to find. I've never seen it off the internet, so I just eventually was like, fuck it, I'm just gonna get it because there's nothing worse. I have this weird OCD. It's another computer thing.
I cannot
have 1, 2, 4, and 5. I need 3.
Rob knows that. I want to read that one because I always had the problem with the script of Part 3. I told that story on Killer PV. We read the script aloud to the movie playing one day, and when we got to the end, the last 20 pages of the script just ends. And it doesn't have the ending of the movie. And whatever version of that script. So I'm like, oh, I wonder what the book does that might be different. So I got to read that one.
Well, you're free to take. I mean, they're there. I loan them out to some people.
It's like a library where we come and read there and we have to leave the book.
Make post-its like I do.
Like Brian Collins. There's some people that are so into them, they want to read them. But he was very into April Fool's Day because where the movie ends, the book's got another 45 pages.
Yeah, that to me is so interesting. Yeah. So I guess we're your target audience for this.
We're
going to geek out.
It started as horror, to be honest. You know, we're all the same in this, but it really grew into just a story of the authors. Like I mentioned Dennis Etchison earlier, he was writing that under like Jack White, like another, I think it was Jack White, but he was writing it under a pen name because it was almost embarrassing to be writing these things at the time. It's just some garbage that's going to end up in Vaughn's at the Spindle, you know, next to Beverly Hills Cop 2 and whatever else.
One, the thing that people don't realize, and I got this from Steven, was that a lot of these were being written before the author had seen the movie.
Oh yeah.
So that's why these are so different. And some of them are just like the differences can become. I'll be interested, what I'm most interested when I see this is to see which ones are the ones that are just crazy different.
Yeah,
I think one of the ideas I threw out to Stephen was visually, because it's going to be, you guys are going to be having to come up with visuals. It'd be really cool to be watching the movie scene that from the actual movie, but hearing and seeing like graphics saying interior, like of something totally different from the book, or hearing the author speak aloud words that are just totally in contrast to what you're watching. Because like seeing that contrast in movies it never stops being interesting, I think.
Yeah.
Right. I'm with you. No, there's a very clever device that I've come up with to visualize the various ones we focus on. So I don't want to talk about it, but it's definitely cool.
Keep us in
nice.
That's awesome. All right, well, Jim, thank you so much for coming
in.
This is it? Are you kidding? I thought we were just getting warmed up. This is beautiful.
When I have to go to the bathroom, we end the show.
Yes.
Oh. All right, good. I don't need to go through any of my notes then, right?
No, you brought notes?
Well, I wouldn't know what I was supposed to talk about. These were all the things that I was like.
Oh, my God, guys. He has, like, pages of notes.
Well, I mean, we can
These are ones I went to each company I work with. Severin, Blue Underground, Vinegar Syndrome, Code Red, Scream Factory, Kino, Arrow, 88 Films, Vestron, AGFA, of what can I talk about? Because I don't know what these guys are going to ask me tonight. Yeah. And so I got a list of, like, well, we've done this. This has been announced. I didn't want to.
We can actually Jim, do a follow-up.
We have to wrap, but I did have one coding question to ask you.
Please do.
That sign that we have to go.
Oh, thanks, Ari. No, seriously, Jim, thanks so much for coming on. And again, unsung hero on all these releases.
Completely.
And we'll see you guys.
We will be back together is Texas Frightmare.
This is true. Next episode is 50 from there. So we will see you on the other side.
In Texas.
It's been fun. Thanks, guys.